Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
If I'm a slave, call me a slave. Don't tell me that I'm a free person and I'm still a slave. Yeah, that really lulls me to sleep. You're not really a slave, you know. You're a co-worker. You know, you're a member of the firm, you know. This is the Bodie Plantation, you know. And you are one of our business associates. Now, get that plow moving. Boy, I'm really working out now. I mean, boy, the sweat is flying, whatnot, and I'm behind that mule, and I'm grinning. I'm a business associate at the Bodie Plantation. Man, I feel great. Get up, mule.
Nearly 250 years ago, a group of white men gathered in a house in Massachusetts. Their task? Draft a document on independence aimed at the British Crown. And as New England Public Radio's Nancy Cohen reports, a woman enslaved in the house overheard the discussion and determined it applied to her too.
A child was born enslaved south of Albany, New York, around 1742. She was called Bette. When she was in her teens, she was brought to this house in Sheffield, Massachusetts. She cleaned, cooked, and served the family of John Ashley. In the upstairs study on a winter's day in 1773, Ashley and other men gathered to write what became known as the Sheffield Resolves.
We have a copy of it here.
Mark Wilson of the Trustees, a nonprofit which owns this house now, says Bette probably overheard these ideas being discussed.
Resolved that mankind in a state of nature are equal, free, and independent of each other.
Historian Emily Blank of Rowan University says about 2% of the population in Massachusetts was enslaved in the 1770s. At that same time, white residents of the colonies, like Ashley, argued that America should be a country of freedom.
They actually complained that they were being enslaved to the British. And so enslaved people also were starting to demand that they should be free, because slavery was inconsistent with this new rhetoric and new idea of what America was going to be as something separate from England.
Clark University historian Usman Power Green and others believe that when Bette heard these discussions about liberty, they resonated with her.
It's the moment that these same white people are articulating that verbally and are writing it down and proclaiming it that are going to encourage her to go ahead and try to see if those would manifest in her actual freedom.
About a decade later, a pivotal moment in this house changed everything. A young girl, a relative of Bette's, put a piece of dough left over from baking for the Ashleys into the hearth for herself. Ashley's wife got angry, grabbed a shovel from the fireplace, and Bette got in between.
Put her arm in the way and then was struck by this, which left a scar that she would, of course, hold out for people to sort of see and wear it as a sort of illustration, a sort of violence that she endured as an enslaved person in the household.
Wilson says Bette trudged away from the house several miles through deep snow.
She has the resilience to just bundle up and walk to the home of the young Theodore Sedgwick, a lawyer, and ask for a suit for her freedom.
Sedgwick was one of the men Bette had overheard writing the Sheffield Resolves. He agreed to represent her, but he was also someone who had purchased enslaved people. That may seem surprising today, but Peter Drummy of the Massachusetts Historical Society says it reflects a duality of ideas in white revolutionary America.
There's a paradox in early American history where people can argue for personal liberty and later on for independence, and at the same time be active participants in the system of enslaving people, both directly, personally, as in the case of Theodore Sedgwick, or living in a society where the economy is supported by slavery everywhere.
Emily Blank says historians don't know for sure, but she believes Sedgwick wanted to know if slavery was still legal under the new Massachusetts Constitution.
it declared that all men are born free and equal. And Sedgwick and others believed that this was inconsistent with holding people in slavery in the state.
Sedgwick won the case, and Bett won her freedom. After another successful freedom case, the state's legal institutions no longer supported slavery. That doesn't mean it disappeared, but about a decade later, no one in Massachusetts reported to the census that they owned slaves. Bett now called herself Elizabeth Freeman. She worked for about 20 years as a paid housekeeper for Theodore Sedgwick, who went on to become Speaker of the U.S. House. It wasn't until she was in her 60s that Freeman moved to her own property with her family. Elizabeth Freeman is buried here in the inner circle of the Sedgwick family plot. For NPR News, I'm Nancy Cohen in Stockbridge, Massachusetts.
Finally tonight, we look at the struggle of painter Jacob Lawrence. In the 1950s, amid the McCarthy hearings and the launch of the civil rights movement, Lawrence decided to frame early American history as he saw it. Now his sprawling series called Struggle has been reassembled at the Peabody Essex Museum in Massachusetts, the first stop on a national tour. Special correspondent Jared Bowen of WGBH Boston takes us there as part of our ongoing series on arts and culture, Canvas.
In 1954, the late painter Jacob Lawrence began a series he called Struggle, from the history of the American people. The most famous black artist of his time, he originally thought he might depict African-American struggle. He soon reconsidered.
When there's issues of unrest or struggle, it's a story that is an effect of a whole society, not a small group within a society.
Over 2 years, Lawrence painted a series of 30 panels. From Patrick Henry's struggle to reconcile the coexistence of liberty and slavery, to the harrowing push for westward expansion. Artist Derek Adams has been taking the panels in one at a time, including this depiction of a slave revolt in 1810.
The way the body is kind of like stretched across the plane of the painting, when you look at the work, there's no space to not acknowledge the scene.
Here at the Peabody Essex Museum, these panels are together for the first time in more than 60 years.
We have assembled and tracked and researched and investigated. It's been a little bit like being a detective.
Austin Baron Bailey is one of the show's curators. 6 years in the making, the exhibition features most of the original works.
There are panels that remain completely unlocated, and those are either in private hands or lost.
The whereabouts of five paintings is unknown, although the hunt is on. This one, panel 19, turned up at a New York auction as Bailey was working on the show.
That must have been ridiculously exciting.
It was incredibly exciting. These are the accidents of history that have informed this show, that even informed Lawrence's work.
A darling of the modern art world, Lawrence was 37 when he began Struggle. Almost 15 years earlier, he created the Migration series, a critically acclaimed effort featuring the move of black Americans from the rural South to the urban North.
The artist Steve Locke, who contributed to our catalog, likes to describe the Migration series as kind of his greatest hit, but the Struggle series as the better record.
By the time he put paint to canvas, Lawrence had spent more than 5 years researching American history, combing through historical records and teasing out quotations that would serve as his prompt.
He looked for the voices of founding fathers. He looked for these actions that people took in the struggle to build our democracy. And he offers it up as a way through these incredible paintings to draw you in.
Lawrence's take on history is an intimate one. Where Paul Revere gave us the Boston Massacre in full-blown battle, Lawrence delivered us straight to its first victim. Where Emmanuel Leutz gave us a valiant George Washington crossing the Delaware, Lawrence delivers despair.
Cold, suffering, choppy weather, hints of blood, robed men trying to stay warm, hands, emphasizing these hands, trying to row across silently, steadfastly. And there's no sense of who, if any of these people, would be George Washington.
Well, it's struggle. It's not heroism as we might know it here.
Exactly. And I think from Lawrence's perspective, the heroism is the collective endeavor.
Each panel is relatively small, just 12 by 16 inches, and Lawrence routinely wrote notes about his process on the backs of the works, all as it related to struggle.
I think about someone like Jacob at a time where artists like him had very little opportunity to experience themselves as an artist.
A widely exhibited artist himself, Derek Adams, says Lawrence, who died in 2000, has influenced his career more than any other painter. He points out the two bear a strikingly similar resemblance, and he even once escorted Lawrence around New York's Pratt Institute, where Adams was a student.
I felt like he was a Jacob to me than a Mr. Lawrence. I don't know. It just seemed like he was very, like, approachable and very modest in personality. I felt like we were more just more in kinship.
The exhibition closes with an installation Derek Adams created after sifting through Lawrence's archives. It's an imaginary studio filled with photographs never before shown publicly. The chair is Lawrence's, oriented, it seems, for quiet contemplation, and facing a ladder, perhaps lifting Lawrence out of struggle.
You know, the ladder, I think, has to do with just the idea of the plight, his career, the plight of humanity. Jacob, you know, starting from this very familiar place of being seated and thinking, and then the part of kind of ascending, he's no longer with us. But there's things that kind of give us a bigger picture of who Jacob was.
Which is of an artist defined in part by struggle. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Jared Bowen in Salem, Massachusetts.
This the city of Chicago.
In the Democratic primary for Cook County State's attorney, three candidates are trying to unseat Kim Fox. They're all hammering her on how she handled the case of celebrity Jussie Smollett.
You should have gotten up in front of the public and said, here's why I dropped the charges.
Jussie Smollett was treated differently from everybody else.
What upsets me the most is the unequal justice involved here.
Smollett is the TV actor accused of staging a hate crime against himself last year and reporting falsely about it to Chicago police. Fox said she tried to help Smollett when she thought he was a victim. When he became the suspect, she publicly recused herself from the case, but then privately continued to influence it. Then her office abruptly dropped all the charges against him. That made national headlines and led to condemnation of Fox, especially by police who'd spent a lot of time investigating the alleged hoax. Nearly a year later, Smollett is center stage in the state's attorney's race. WBEZ's Chip Mitchell reports on how the scandals impacted Fox's base of support.
When Kim Fox ran for state's attorney in 2016, she promised two big things. One was to help tamp down a surge in violent crime. The other was to carry out criminal justice reforms. She had a lot of support from Black Lives Matter activists and from groups that try to get progressives elected. I reached more than a dozen of these Fox supporters to find out what they think of her tenure as state's attorney and how the Jussie Smollett case has affected their view. One of them is Krista Noel, a founder of a group called Women's All Points Bulletin.
It was a little shady the way she recused herself.
Then Noel remembers Fox's office let Smollett walk away
without having to say that he did anything wrong.
But she says ultimately that decision to drop the charges was in keeping with what Fox promised to do.
He lost his job. He paid $10,000. Did he need to be jailed or imprisoned?
Jussie Smollett doesn't affect people's lives in the way that the real reforms that Kim Fox has made in her first term in office, and the ways that those reforms have affected people's lives.
Amisha Patel heads Grassroots Illinois Action.
For us, it was a no-brainer to endorse her once again. Our people don't care about this actor. They care about their family members and their neighbors on their block, and they care about what's happening as people interact with the criminal justice system in Cook County.
Activists say Smollett is insignificant compared to the office's other responsibilities, like prosecuting all the murders in Chicago and suburban Cook County and having control, or at least influence, over expungements, wrongful convictions, incarceration rates. Anti-gun violence activist Camila Williams says Fox's mishandling of the Smollett case is nothing compared to how previous state's attorneys turned a blind eye to the now well-documented torture of African-American suspects under Police Commander John Burge.
Torture, letting police officers go, this Jussie Smollett situation, that's pure irrelevance to people who are impacted by gun violence every day, that are traumatized, that have PTSD. And I'm one of them. I don't even want to hear it no more.
I reached many other people who helped elect Fox 4 years ago, activists, reform-minded attorneys, nonprofit groups. I couldn't find any who left her camp because of Smollett. Sun-Times and ABC7 analyst Laura Washington says that's not surprising because these groups have closer ties to the people Fox talks about helping.
The people who have benefited most from her policies are people of color in low-income communities.
And who are the voters most likely to be swayed by the Smollett talk?
People who don't live in the communities and don't connect with the communities where the crime is happening, where the injustices are happening. They have a right to be angry about the bungling of this case, but they are not living those injustices.
Washington says these are the people Fox's challengers need to turn out.
I think if Kim Fox loses this race, it's going to be because of Jussie Smollett.
The election is March 17th. Early voting starts across Cook County today. Chip Mitchell, WBEZ News.
The gay rights movement is changing everything.
A group of students in South Carolina want the freedom to learn about LGBTQ relationships in the classroom. Right now, it's illegal in South Carolina for teachers to bring up non-heterosexual relationships during health class, unless it's about sexually transmitted infections. Lambda Legal and the National Center for Lesbian Rights are trying to force the state to change the 32-year-old law. Those organizations have successfully overturned similar laws in Utah and in Arizona. They say the South Carolina law also violates the Constitution. Eli Bundy is a 10th grade student at Charleston County School of the Arts who leads their school's Gender and Sexuality Alliance, one of the plaintiffs in the case. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So what is it like to be in a classroom where your relationships aren't even spoken about or can't be spoken about?
Well, it's certainly very frustrating to be in a classroom with my friends, with my peers, and to feel that me and my fellow LGBTQ classmates are not being given equal treatment and equal education in regards to health and sex ed.
So it's not just about relationships, but it's really about your health as well, right?
Yeah, it is. And it's not only about sexual health, but there's also a lot of concerns surrounding suicide rates and certainly depression and anxiety rates among LGBTQ youth. And so not only is there the primary effect of not be giving sex education, but then also the secondary effect of feeling rejected and not accepted in your school environment.
Critics of this, of overturning this law, would say something like, we don't think it should be in the schools. What do you say to them?
Well, to that, I would say, sex education reform is a completely separate issue. We're not advocating for what should or should not be taught in the classroom. Specifically, what we're advocating for here is equal treatment. And currently in South Carolina, heterosexual students receive education about sexual health, and LGBTQ students do not receive that education about their health. And so, whether or not you support sex education in schools is irrelevant in this case, because really what we are asking for is not for specific things to be taught, but just for the same things to be taught across the board for people of all identities.
You're 15 and you're suing the state. That's kind of a big step. Why are you so passionate about it? What do you want to get out of this lawsuit?
LGBTQ teens need support, and especially at the state level, being discriminated against in your own classroom is just unacceptable. In addition to the health of teenagers, I also think it's important to just send a message to LGBTQ kids and LGBTQ people across the state, which is that South Carolina recognizes you, that it sees you, and even if it in the past has discriminated against LGBTQ people, that hopefully with the filing of this lawsuit, that discrimination will be slowly taken out of the state law books.
Eli Bundy's a 10th grade student at Charleston County School of the Arts and the president of the Gender and Sexuality Alliance there. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
The public school. We call it the Killing Fields.
Discussing racism can be difficult, especially with elementary students. A project at UNC Greensboro gives future elementary school teachers the tools to teach diverse classrooms about racism through reading. Liz Schlemmer has the story.
On a recent Saturday, the International Civil Rights Center and Museum at the Old Woolworths in Greensboro was buzzing with visitors. The museum is celebrating the 60th anniversary of the lunch counter sit-ins there that ignited a movement. In a quiet room in the basement, UNC Greensboro education student Shelby Morris prepares a reading lesson for whoever might walk through the door. She has chosen a picture book about the Greensboro sit-ins to read aloud.
The introduction to my lesson is, you know, where you're sitting is actually where this happens.
On each page of the book, she has stuck bright pink Post-it notes with questions for students. Questions about big, difficult topics like racism, segregation, and white supremacy. She's ready, but a little nervous.
The first step is just telling yourself, it's okay that I don't know everything. My students may have more knowledge than I do, and that's okay. We're learning together.
In walks a Girl Scout troop from Raleigh. Most of the children and parents in the room are African American. Morris, like a majority of elementary teachers in North Carolina, is white. She reads aloud and engages students with her questions.
Who has the power in the situation? How does the store manager show his power over the Greensboro Four when he brings in a police officer and says you have to leave?
A second grader named Erica is wearing a sweatshirt with a logo for North Carolina A&T State University, the historically black college the four protesters attended. Just as Morris anticipated, Erica knows a few things.
So what movement, what is that called?
The Civil Rights Movement.
Very good. Did everyone hear what Erica said?
The point here is for future teachers like Morris to have the confidence to tackle these topics, especially with students who have a different background than her.
It's something I think about a lot. The school I was at last semester in an elementary classroom, you know, the majority of the students were African American. So the students, a lot of the times, don't look like me.
UNC Greensboro education professor Ryan Hughes organized the project. He'll use observations from these story hours to inform how he teaches the next generation of educators.
You know, if we don't teach and talk about race, that's a move that just holds white supremacy and racism in place. If we don't continue to have those conversations and puzzle through and muddle through how we might do it, we're not going to see any change.
Morris says after this first try, she feels more prepared and more likely to plan a lesson like this for another class.
Now I have like a checklist that I can go down when I pull a book. Okay, I want to talk about women's history. Let me pull some books. Let me look through them and see, is this really a good text? And if it's not, can I still use it in a way to benefit my students?
After story hour ended, the Girl Scouts toured the museum, including a trip upstairs to the famous lunch counter where the sit-ins began.
Is this the actual counter?
The girls walked through exhibits and faced hard images from the Jim Crow era. Here's second grader Erica again.
I felt sorry for all the people. I didn't know that that happened, and I didn't know they got burned, bombed, and everything like that.
One thing that left an imprint on Erica was just how recent this history is. Kids gasped when their tour guide explained that Ruby Bridges, who desegregated an elementary school at the age of six, is still alive. Here's Erica and her mom, Vicky Meadows.
She's younger than your grandma because she's 65 now.
Oh.
And Ma is 73. So Ruby Bridges is still alive.
So Ma
went through that, yeah. You can ask her when you go home. She'll tell you all about it.
And the conversation continues. The story hour at the International Civil Rights Center and Museum will continue every second and fourth Saturday of the month all year, with different themes about race each month. Liz Schlemmer, North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC.
I don't want us to lose sight that things are getting better. Each successive generation seems to be making progress in changing attitudes when it comes to race. Doesn't mean we're in a post-racial society. It doesn't mean that racism is eliminated. But, you know, when I talk to Malia and Sasha, and I listen to their friends, and I see them interact. They're better than we are. They're better than we were on these issues. And that's true in every community that I've visited all across the country.
Difficult testimony today at a hotel in East Regina as an inquest got underway into the suicide of a 13-year-old boy.
His mother was the first to testify, explaining the bullying he was facing while he was a student at a Balgoni school. Stephanie Davis was at the inquest today and joins us now live in our newsroom. And Steph, take us what you heard today.
Well, 13-year-old Caleb Schmidt was found unresponsive on his family farm on April 30th of 2018 and was pronounced dead on scene by EMS. Today, Sandra Barker Schmidt, Caleb's mother, was the first to testify on the first day of the inquest, and she confirmed her son died by suicide. She described Caleb as charming, handsome, and intelligent, saying, quote, his smile would light up a room. She and her husband adopted Caleb and his two younger sisters from Ethiopia when Caleb was seven. Caleb was a student at Greenall High School, where his mom says he was being bullied and had been called the N-word several times. After the first couple of instances, he walked away, but as it continued, she says he reacted physically and punched the students who had said the racial slurs in the face. He was suspended from school as a result. Barker Schmidt says she talked with school staff about the situation, but doesn't know if any action was ever taken against the students who allegedly were bullying Caleb. On April 26th of 2018, Caleb was suspended for knocking another student's teeth out for bullying him. His mother says he was then charged with assault causing bodily harm. RCMP officers arrived at their farm on Sunday, April 29th, to lay the charges. The next day, she says Caleb took his life. Barker Schmidt says her son had talked about suicide prior to the day he died and says sometimes he lashed out in the home. His parents sought help from psychologists for his mental health, and Barker Schmidt says they also reached out to friends, RCMP, and social services over the years for support. Caleb's mother says she wanted this inquest in hopes of preventing another family from going through what the Schmidt family has gone through and continues to go through. A six-person jury will listen to testimony from about 27 witnesses over the next 2 weeks and will compile recommendations to prevent similar situations from happening in the future. Day two will start tomorrow at 9:30 a.m.
All right. Thanks a lot, Stephanie. Stephanie Davis reporting live from our newsroom.
Big trouble in Big China. The novel coronavirus has brought the world's second biggest economy to a virtual standstill. That's because China is the workhouse of the West, where cars, computers, iPhones, clothes, and a wealth of other items gets constructed. China's labor force is the key to capitalist production of almost everything. And when it stops, as it has during the emergence of the coronavirus, almost everything stops as it ripples through economies worldwide. The U.S. economy lost trillions in 1 week on the stock markets. After NAFTA in the 90s, U.S. corporations fled abroad in search of ever cheaper labor. Mexico, Vietnam, China. China has a vast labor force and did a slew of deals that resulted in factories sprouting like mushrooms in the dark. The emergence of the novel coronavirus shows how closely we all work together in this new neoliberal world. And guess what? It ain't over. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
Seattle's a great place to visit because it has, I guess you could say, a little bit of everything, but I like to think of it as a lot of everything.
The U.S. response to coronavirus has been hobbled by a lack of testing, so federal officials are now allowing certain laboratories to provide their own tests for the virus. NPR's John Hamilton visited one of those labs. It's in Seattle, at the center of the country's worst outbreak.
It's been a busy week at the virology lab run by the University of Washington's Medical School.
We've already gone to three shifts. You know, people are going to be here basically all the time.
Dr. Keith Jerome is the scientist in charge. He says the lab is processing about 100 coronavirus tests a day, but is prepared to do more than 1,000 a day immediately and could quickly increase that to 4,000. Jerome shows me a machine that extracts genetic material from specimens.
That all happens robotically. You can see the arms in here moving back and forth. This robot is working on 96 specimens at a time. We have two of them. This is part of the magic for getting so many specimens through this laboratory.
In another part of the lab is a room full of instruments that take bits of genetic material from a virus and make millions of copies. Jerome says that's critical for detecting an infection.
Right now, this is our limiting factor. We've got to call out to the rest of the university, does anyone have any more that match these models? And if they do, can we borrow them?
The lab's readiness is the result of months of planning. Jerome says he and other virologists started the process in January after hearing reports about the coronavirus outbreak in China.
Our opinion was, this is probably not going to be a problem. This is probably going to be a waste of our effort and some money, but we owe it to the people of our area to be prepared.
So they developed a test and began using it in a research setting. Dr. Alex Greninger, the lab's assistant director, says tests of early samples found no infections. Then, nearly a week ago, he says, one came back positive.
That was on Friday at 4 p.m., and then Saturday morning, the FDA came out with new regulation that allowed us to perform testing.
On Monday and Tuesday, the lab quietly began accepting specimens for clinical use and preparing for high-volume testing.
It was intense.
Late nights, lots of pressure. But Greninger says the hard part wasn't the testing procedure itself, but the logistics.
How many swabs you're going to take from each patient, how you're going to handle sending results and samples to the state public health lab.
Then yesterday, Jerome and Greninger held a press conference to announce that the lab was officially open for business. Jerome anticipates an avalanche of specimens, and he says that's a good thing.
Access to testing is really the major tool that we have right now to fight this new coronavirus.
But Jerome adds that testing is still limited to people who have symptoms like fever and a dry cough.
My goal is that everyone who needs a test can get one, and that might be different from everyone who wants a test.
Local doctors say the lab will make a huge difference.
It's a game changer.
Dr. Seth Cohen is an infectious disease expert at the University of Washington's Northwest Hospital.
Previously, when we would send the tests to the CDC in Atlanta, it was taking between 3 and 5 days to get those tests back.
Now results often come back the same day. Cohen says that means doctors and hospitals can focus resources on patients who are truly infected.
We did not plan on being at the epicenter of one of the outbreaks in the United States, and we are preparing for the worst.
Cohen says that preparation will be critical if the coronavirus continues to spread. John Hamilton, NPR News, Seattle.
You dirt. We think you're dirt, Paul. Who is we? The West, all the superpowers, everything you believe in, Paul. They think you're dirt. They think you're dumb. You're worthless.
I'm afraid I don't understand what you are saying, sir.
Oh, come on. Don't bullshit me, Paul. You're the smartest man here. You got them all eating out of your hands. You could own this freaking hotel, except for one thing. You're black. You're not even a nigger. You're an African.
Five African countries have now reported cases of the coronavirus. Yesterday, Senegal announced that a man came back infected after a ski vacation in France. In Nigeria, it was an Italian flying in for work who tested positive. In East Africa, Kenya has reported no cases yet, but there are concerns there over how little that country seems prepared for an outbreak. NPR's Ada Peralta reports.
An airline employee was the first to raise an alarm with this video posted online.
This is today on 26th of February. So China Southern is back again.
It shows an arriving China Southern airplane with more than 200 passengers taxiing to its gate at Nairobi's main international airport. The video unleashed a torrent of public criticism. In huge font on the front page of The Standard, one of the big newspapers here, editors branded the government officials who allowed that flight in, quote, enemies of the people. The Law Society of Kenya took the government to court.
And it was filed not just because the flight was allowed in, but also because there was a complete lack of action by the government.
That's Dudley Ochiel, one of the attorneys on the case. He says when they looked at what steps the government had taken to prepare for the arrival of the new coronavirus, they were shocked.
There was no information on symptoms, on where to go for help, on numbers to call to report suspected cases, no isolation wards, no quarantine facilities. There was just no plan.
The court ordered direct flights from China suspended, and it asked the government to actually prepare and present a contingency plan. Soon after, President Uhuru Kenyatta announced a 21-member task force.
There is an executive order, which I expect you to begin implementing immediately, so that we can ensure our people generally are safe.
Health officials have warned that an epidemic on the African continent could be much deadlier than in China because hospitals here are ill-prepared to handle the most severe cases. At Uhuru Park, in the middle of downtown Nairobi, I find two friends protesting the government response to coronavirus. They're wearing latex gloves and homemade masks. They had to make their own using paper towels, staples, and rubber bands because there is now a shortage in Nairobi. Musungu Gabar says the government doesn't care about them.
If I thought it was a caring government, they could have had even civic education so that people can understand what is coronavirus.
And perhaps to make that point, I find 20-year-old Lorna Seremitin Tutu out for a stroll with a friend. I ask them what they know about COVID-19.
Yeah, that is killing people. There's no cure.
Do you guys know the symptoms of it?
No.
No?
I don't know, but I heard there's diarrhea, maybe there's headache.
I ask if she trusts that Kenya has this under control.
Yes, because when I say that I don't trust them, who am I going to trust? Whom?
She says her best hope is that the virus never gets here. This region already has enough problems, from locusts to Ebola. The new coronavirus, she says, would be yet another way to die. Ada Peralta, NPR News, Nairobi.
Medical apartheid. The dark history of medical experimentation on Black Americans from colonial times to the present.
It's kind of bizarre, really. Asian Americans as a whole tend to be invisible, historically, culturally, and otherwise, until something like this happens.
So a couple of weeks ago, I was organizing a birthday party for a friend.
I was getting on the DC Metro.
I was having dinner at one of my regular restaurants.
My family and I, we were going out to lunch.
I was walking with a colleague at lunch.
I was on the BART train for my morning commute to work.
Some guy at the bar, whom I had never seen before, said, "Do you have the corona?"
They told my wife and son to get away.
Get out of here, go back to China.
People call us corona. People ask us if we eat dogs.
And this kid said, "Well, you're Chinese, so you must have the coronavirus."
Coronavirus.
It's probably coronavirus.
The woman then replied that she isn't racist, but she just doesn't want to get sick.
You're listening to Code Switch from NPR. I'm Gene Demby.
And I'm Shireen Marisol Meraji. The news about COVID-19, a.k.a. coronavirus, has been unsettling. And as the virus spreads, so does suspicion and harassment of Asian Americans.
And we have been here before in the United States because fear of disease and xenophobia have often gone hand in hand, or unwashed hand. SARS was associated with Chinese people. Ebola was associated with Africans.
Irish as, typhus carriers, or Jewish, Italians, and others from Southern and Eastern Europe as bringing tuberculosis and smallpox.
That's Erica Lee. She's a historian at the University of Minnesota and author of America for Americans, A History of Xenophobia in the United States.
Historians have pointed out that in times of epidemics like this, that existing prejudices, existing ideas about certain groups get medicalized. So it's no mistake that certain diseases get attached to immigrant groups that are the perceived threat of the time.
Groups like the Irish and Italians eventually folded into whiteness and are no longer considered a threat. Now, Italy has the highest rates of coronavirus deaths outside of China as of when we recorded this episode.
You know, I doubt that we're going to see the same types of exclusions or informal acts of discrimination targeting Italians or Italian restaurants or Italian communities in the same way that we're seeing this with China.
Professor Lee, welcome back to Code Switch.
Thank you.
We heard from a lot of people from across the country who've experienced discrimination. They've experienced name-calling, bullying, you know, being told to cover their mouths and people walking away from them if they're Asian and they happen to sneeze, these kinds of things. And this has all been in the wake of the coronavirus news. What have you been hearing?
So I think there have been a number of incidents that I began to read about and hear about in January, most of them outside of the United States. Restaurants in Vietnam putting signs on the outside of their doors barring Chinese people. A lot of so-called yellow peril rhetoric that was being circulated in French newspapers. The incident at UC Berkeley that was, I think, initiated by the health services that said, I think it was an Instagram post, and essentially said that there may be very common responses to anxiety about the coronavirus, including xenophobia directed at Asians. And because of a backlash, that post was then deleted. But then, of course, there are countless incidents similar to the ones that callers have just relayed of informal as well as just explicit racism, assuming that because someone is Chinese or Asian appearing, that they are carriers of this disease.
You've written that these fears have actually influenced American immigration policy. Tell us a little bit about that.
Some of them predate even, you know, Chinese immigration to the United States. It's part of a larger oriental discourse of China and Asia being uncivilized, impoverished, unsanitary, and, you know, crowded, you know, the teeming hordes of millions living in filth. And then as Americans who traveled to China and then came back to the United States, they spread those ideas. And then as Chinese people started to migrate to the United States, those ideas became even more entrenched in popular culture and then also in public policy. So we know from the very beginning, as West Coast Americans and as Americans in general are starting to debate the so-called problem of Chinese immigration, they are explicitly tying China, Chinese people, Chinese spaces with disease and contagion. Historians have shown that the rhetoric is about Chinatown as plague spots, as cesspools of laboratories of infection. And we see in congressional records how these ideas get part of the public record, part of American public policy. And they're used as justifications for immigration exclusion, as well as specific policies to try to deal with outbreaks of disease.
I can hear people listening to this possibly being like, okay, yes, all of this was way back in the day, but right now I'm rightfully anxious about getting sick and my family getting sick. How does being anxious and cautious transform into xenophobia?
So there's much that we don't know about COVID-19, but many of the things that we do know about it is that it is spread through contact and through not washing your hands, you know, just like the flu. So we know that as long as we can use those just common sense precautions, we can protect ourselves against the virus. What is happening in this current environment with, I know there's a lot of global anxiety. I know there's a lot of anxiety within the U.S. as we see in the news headlines, the number of cases being reported, the number of deaths being reported. Racist scapegoating and outright discrimination does not have to accompany this anxiety. It is an unfortunate sort of echo of the past, but it doesn't have to be. It would seem that we should have learned some of these lessons as we talk about this history and know how unjustified these ideas were and how racist and discriminatory the policies were, they have been discredited in the past. And to see some of the same both informal and formal discrimination happening today is pretty discouraging.
So you have a chapter in your book called Getting Rid of the Mexicans.
Mm-hmm.
And you also talk about how this is something that it was used against Mexicans in the United States. You said that there was a near hysterical campaign depicting Mexicans as dirty and diseased, carrying diseases like typhus, plague, smallpox. When was this and what was going on at that time?
This campaign targeting Mexicans as an immigrant invasion, but also as a racially inferior threat, is happening at the same time as the campaign targeting Chinese. And this is one of the ways in which xenophobia works. It uses an already existing playbook. You know, certain immigrants are threats. They're threats because they bring crime, also because they take away jobs, but also because they bring disease. And they are sort of genetically carriers of disease. So just in the same ways that American policymakers describe Chinese and Chinese communities as places of filth and disease, lawmakers also described Mexican communities as places of laziness, of general squalor, of filth and disease. And when Mexican immigrants arrived across the border, they were routinely subjected to invasive, humiliating, and harmful disinfecting baths using pesticides to rout out louse, but also to cleanse, you know, Mexican peoples, their clothing, and their baggage before entering the United States. This is much harsher than what happened at Ellis Island, where European immigrants certainly faced scrutiny, but the medical exams were known as 6-second physicals. They were pretty pretty quick. So what's happening at the border is a reflection of the idea that Mexican immigrants are a much greater threat.
Listening to your answer there, it reminds me of some of Shireen's reporting before on the language of vermin as it pertains to immigrants and sort of the dehumanization as it pertains to immigrants to the United States. But it seemed like it also was actualized in policy, this idea that these people were almost like rats carrying bubonic plague. In fact, in 1900, the fear of bubonic plague among Chinese in San Francisco's Chinatown precipitated this quarantine of Chinatown, and they like disinfected the entire community. Could you tell us about what that process looked like?
Yeah. This idea that immigrants, but particularly Chinese immigrants, are vermin infested. I think we see some of that rhetoric today too, but it has really deep roots, and it is in one way, very applicable to lots of immigrant groups, but there is a particular way in which it has been racialized with Chinese. Chinese as dog eaters, as eaters of weird and strange animals, including rats and mice. There's a pretty famous 19th century advertisement for a rat poison that's called Rough on Rats, and the image of it is of a Chinaman, a stereotypically drawn Chinese immigrant male in Chinese robes with the queue and, you know, sort of colorized deeply yellow, eating, like literally about to bite into a full-grown rat. You know, so on the one hand, that message is, hey, the Chinese are are good exterminators of rats, and so is this poison. Buy this poison. But also, of course, is the message that the Chinese have these completely strange and uncivilized eating habits, and that they, if they are eating and consuming rats that are known to spread disease, then Chinese people as a race are also carriers of disease. So that message is very clearly in the minds of officials in San Francisco when bubonic plague is discovered in 1900. It's about pointing the finger at Chinese people as carriers of the disease rather than rats. So when the plague struck and the first instance was found in Chinatown, the city ordered an immediate quarantine of Chinatown with orders to remove all whites from the affected area. So white residents of San Francisco were ordered to leave Chinatown, but Chinese people could not. And the mayor of the time, James Phelan, he would become a national spokesman in the effort to exclude Japanese immigrants in about 20 years. He also warned that no Chinese people should be hired or allowed to work outside of Chinatown.
So we know that during the period in which many Chinese immigrants to the United States were coming to the U.S. through Angel Island, which is in San Francisco Bay, that Chinese immigrants were separated out, even from other Asian immigrants, for special inspection because they were seen as specifically carriers of disease. And I know that you are a descendant of immigrants from China who arrived through Angel Island, correct?
Yes.
Has your family ever told any stories about their experiences coming through Angel Island?
They never talked about their experiences coming through Angel Island, but because I'm a historian, I found the records. And I found the records of my grandparents' interrogations, but especially pertinent to this conversation, my grandfather's medical exam. And it was nothing like anything I've read before. Immigration officials ordered my grandfather to be subjected to the most invasive and humiliating medical exam that I've seen in hundreds of these records. So they had the medical doctor at Angel Island, you know, examine him for diseases, but also to measure every aspect of his body, his teeth, his genitals, his height, to determine what age he was, to determine whether his claim of being 17 when he was immigrating was actually true. And they included just all of these detailed notes in the record, and It was just quite shocking to read.
Wow.
God.
There seems to be this paradox here, right? Like, on one hand, Chinese immigrants and Chinese people in America are held up as, like, model minorities, right?
Yeah.
Uniquely adept at assimilating to culture in the United States, the dominant culture in the United States. But there's also this latent sense that they're still much, these very, like, dirty, backwards others, right, who are sort of scheming and, as you said, disease-plagued. How do we make sense of both of those things sitting next to each other?
You know, one of the things about the model minority is that it's always been a very complicated and complex stereotype. And that is, on the surface, they seem like they're the right kind of immigrant, the right kind of American. But you really can't know for sure. They may still hold allegiances to China, to Japan, to Korea. You know, they may not fully be assimilated as we think. And so there's this scratch the surface and you might reveal the real true nature of the inscrutable Oriental who is actually not assimilated or who is really loyal to another country. This is also a stereotype that goes way back. I was thinking about not just the ways in which these anti-Chinese stereotypes are so endemic to U.S. history, but how global they are. And I think that's another aspect of what we're seeing today, how easily weaponized is certain stereotypes about Chinese are not only, you know, enduring across the decades and centuries, but also how they're globally understood. As I was thinking about this, I remembered this just horribly racist book from Mexico that was published in the early 1920s. It was making the case for the restriction of Chinese immigration. And there's one cartoon, one illustration in it that's called The Terrible Ills of the Orient, Highly Contagious. And it shows Chinese people, Chinese immigrant men, infected with syphilis, with trachoma, with leprosy. It's just really horribly drawn and very graphically drawn to see them as diseased and contagious. But the other part of the caption is that these Chinese people cover their diseases with very clean clothing when they work as waiters in cafes, as launderers or domestic servants.
Wow.
So they're spreaders of disease, but they cover it up really well.
Mm-hmm. Why do I need ID to get ID?
I don't know, BT.
If I had ID, I wouldn't need ID.
Going to the DMV can be a nightmare, and if you've gone lately, you may have noticed longer lines than usual. That's because people around the country are rushing to get their Real ID card before the October 1st deadline. Now, have you heard of the Real ID before? If not, don't worry, you're not alone. Only one-third of people living in the USA actually have one of these little plastic cards.
This is a federally approved identification card that you would pick up from your state DMV. So it would be either a driver's license or a state ID card, but it meets a minimum security standard that's set by the federal government.
That's Stephanie Beasley. She's a transportation security reporter for Politico. Stephanie says to get one of these new IDs, you're going to have to present a whole lot of documentation.
So you would need to bring proof of your U.S. citizenship or residency. You would need to bring proof of your address, your state address, and also proof of your Social Security number.
If you don't have those documents, you will not be able to get a Real ID card. Here in the U.S., you will also no longer be able to fly domestically or enter federal buildings without a Real ID or other form of federally compliant identification, like a U.S. passport, after that deadline. It's going to complicate life for a lot of you. But Stephanie says the new cards are meant to make us all safer.
This is something that they basically enacted following September 11th because some of the hijackers had, you know, state ID cards, but they, of course, they were not U.S. citizens. So this is an extra security precaution to make sure that people aren't entering these buildings who shouldn't be there and people aren't flying if they should not be allowed to fly in the U.S.
So Congress passed this Real ID Act back in 2005, and it's now been 15 years later. Why is it taking so long to implement this?
Well, I think part of the difficulty was this is what you would call an unfunded mandate. So there wasn't any money attached to this, and it's requiring states to change their processes because not all of them were collecting the type of documents that are required. That means they might have to pour resources into new software that they're going to use. Maybe they have to, you know, hire more staff. So I think it's taken a long time for states to get on board with this. And also for them to kind of work with the Department of Homeland Security to make sure that everyone has a clear understanding of what documents are going to be required. For example, you know, I live in Maryland, and last summer they actually discovered that Maryland wasn't collecting all the correct documents. And so they actually had to recall or basically tell people, you need to come back to the DMV and show us these documents. Otherwise, we're going to have to take your ID card back.
There are a lot of folks in this country, and I know quite a few of them, who actually don't have these documents. And if you don't have federal identification, like a passport or a permanent resident card, what do you do?
Basically, you're not going to be able to get one of these Real IDs, and it is going to make it more difficult for you. Say if you worked at a federal facility, maybe you were a janitor or someone else working in there, and now you don't have the Real ID needed to get into the building. Or if you're trying to fly because, you know, some of the alternatives you could use would be like a passport or a military ID if you don't have your Real ID. But if you don't have any of these documents, then basically TSA is not going to allow you on that flight.
Who is responsible for getting the word out about this? Who's in charge of the communication effort?
So I think the responsibility really falls to Homeland Security. And, you know, over the past year, they've had some kind of awareness campaign. So I don't know if you've flown recently, like TSA will have signs up at the checkpoint saying, you know, do you have your Real ID?
You have to supply so much documentation. You got to walk into the DMV. Are there concerns about people's privacy?
That's definitely a big concern, particularly, I think, if you talk about the possibility of them maybe trying to move some elements of this to electronic submission. because then, of course, you have it in a database or you're sending it through the computer. And then there's a possibility of hacking, of course, with anything you're submitting online. So I think privacy concerns have definitely come up as part of these sort of ongoing discussions over the past 14, 15 years, the amount of information that you basically have to take with you.
Thank you so much. Stephanie Beasley covers transportation security for Politico. Stephanie, have a wonderful day.
Thanks, you too.
Let's head over to Alaska, where it's been challenging for some people to get their hands on the new form of ID.
My name is Tess Williams. I'm a reporter at the Anchorage Daily News.
Tess is closely following this story. I asked her, how many Alaskans actually have a real ID?
So 115,000 Alaskans have the real ID so far. There's about 30 other forms of acceptable federally compliant IDs. And our DMV is estimating that almost half of our Alaskans have another form of ID.
So you say in addition to the real ID, there's also 30 other forms of ID that you could use?
Yeah, there's about 30 forms. The biggest ones are like passports, military ID, veterans IDs, and tribal IDs.
Alaska seems synonymous with beautiful landscapes of mountains, greenery, snow, oceans, glaciers, and a lot of rural communities. In the middle of all that natural beauty, where is the DMV?
There are quite a few DMV locations. It is harder, though, in the rural communities because there are not DMVs in every rural community. And the biggest challenge in Alaska is that a lot of our communities are off the road system, so they're not connected by roadways. So to get from one community to the other, you sometimes have to fly.
So what does that mean for people who want to get one of these IDs? Are they actually booking a flight to get to the DMV?
That's something I think our state is still trying to figure out, and we've kind of been evolving plans for that. And so it started kind of with our DMV had this game plan that they announced in December where they asked for donations actually to bring employees out to rural communities. We have a mobile machine that's able to make these real IDs or issue them. However, it's kind of hit some roadblocks. We have some budget issues here in Alaska right now. And so far, our DMV has done one visit to one community. Our DMV has kind of said that there seems to be a lot of people who do have tribal IDs and is also leaning towards maybe that is the best like way to go for a lot of these rural communities also, just because the real ID requires like so much documentation to get one, which is kind of another barrier for getting one in a lot of places, too.
So in light of all this difficulty trying to get workers to these isolated communities, is the state, did I understand you correctly, actually pushing for the use of tribal IDs or alternative forms of ID?
They've said that there doesn't seem to be as much of a need for real ID as they had initially thought. The push right away was that everyone needs a real ID. If you don't comply, you don't fly was kind of the slogan that I think TSA put out initially and that Alaska had really touted back in December as a big thing. And then I think they have realized just how many barriers there are.
If the deadline comes and not enough people have actually gotten a real ID, what are some of the consequences that you foresee based on your reporting?
I think some things that lawmakers have been really concerned about and some tribal leaders and people have testified during hearings have been very concerned about, I think the biggest one is like medical access. In a lot of these cases, you have to fly to go see a doctor if you live in a rural community. Sometimes if there's like a medical flight, a medevac flight, a patient is taken via like life flight helicopter into a bigger hospital like Anchorage or even Seattle. In that case, you would be able to get there if you didn't have a real ID. But then how do you get home afterward? You would need like real ID or federally compliant ID to get back home on a commercial flight.
It seems like Alaska is really pushing back on the federal government. Is there any indication that the U.S. government might give Alaska a little bit of leeway?
At this point, it does not seem like there would be another extension. I know Alaska's had several extensions, and when Real ID passed, there was a lot of contention at our state, and it was kind of met with bipartisan opposition, just because Alaskans didn't view it as necessary and saw it kind of as like an overarching federal mandate and worried that it might be expensive at the state level to enforce.
Tess Williams is a reporter at the Anchorage Daily News. Tess, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me on. I appreciate it.
And you can find information about Real IDs at dhs.gov/real-id.
Context of white supremacy. Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Saturday, March 7, 2020. So I have been told. I have also been told, spring forward, as they say. So you're supposed to move the clock forward 1 hour this evening. 1 hour. We're losing 1 hour sleep. I guess I can do all my PSAs at the beginning. Sobriety would be best under conditions of white supremacy. So with moving the clock forward 1 hour, I said this yesterday. I didn't find this information out until recently, and I don't even really recall the context of how I got this information, except I think it's yoga related, because I think often it is mentioned or it'll be talked about, like, oh, moving the clock forward and sleep and all that. But I mean, that is true, that it has an enormous impact. The reason I remember it is because it is amazing how sensitive human beings are. Moving that clock forward 1 hour tonight, whites have done studies where there is a 10% increase. I might be a slight bit off in the numbers, but I mean, it's significant. I believe it was 10. I'll double check. Increase in traffic accidents on Monday morning. And they believe that that is a direct correlation to losing that hour of sleep. And people still, you know, trying to get their bearings. Even by Monday morning, they still haven't quite got it together. And you hear and see a lot of people who say, oh man, the clock going forward, it, you know, had an impact, and I feel a little tired, and I haven't really I know I feel that way. Every year I feel that way. It is super aggressive. It takes me about a month or so to kind of adjust and get back with it. I feel the folks there. I guess there is a movement to do away with daylight savings time, to banish it completely. I feel them completely, and I think it has passed in some states, but that is a federal law. So just because they pay, it's kind of like the cannabis thing. Just because you pass it at the state level does not mean anything about, you know, changes to federal law. So you cannot change daylight saving time at the state level. That is something that the folks in Congress would have to sit down and come to an agreement on. That said, speaking of Congress and all that, our PSA. So our PSA with daylight savings time, get your rest. Try to go to bed early. Make sure tonight is not one of those nights where you stay up really late, binge watching anything on Netflix or anything like that. Get your rest so that you can be ready to roll for the beginning of the week. Next PSA, I think some dang-blang idiot has been talking about get your passport. Even if you don't plan on being at the COWS counter-racist yoga retreat in Toronto, get your passport. It would be a good document to have. If there is any problem with a real ID, or if you are just not motivated to get one, like myself, I do not have a real ID, but I did get my passport in the mail this week, so good to go for international and domestic flights. Take your passport. You should be good to go. No problem. So get your passport. If you don't want to get a real ID, if you're reluctant, you can get a passport. I think it's cheaper, at least in some areas. I don't think the enhanced ID or whatever they call it, real ID, I don't think it's too expensive in Washington State. But I know in some states it's kind of pricey, at least what I think of as pricey, to get one of those enhanced IDs. So if you don't want to do that, you can get your passport. It's $145 to get the passport book, and that is valid for 10 years. Maybe a little short of 10 years, because for a lot of countries, if you're going to go, the passport has to be valid. It cannot be expiring in the next 6 months. So if you want to think of it, it's generally valid for 9 years, 9.5 years. Think of it that way. 9.5 years. If it's going to expire in the next 6 months, generally most so-called countries want you to renew it before they will allow you access to their country. Get your passport, regardless of whether you're going to the retreat. Good document to have. Same thing I said last week. You never know. Idea The coronavirus might be on your block next. This is a grand time to visit Brazil. Always wanted to go there. Matter of fact, go to Cuba too. They got universal health care there. That way, in case anything happens, should be good for me to get some medical attention. Let's go to Cuba until this all settles down. Folks got the sniffles on my block. Get your passport. Speaking of retreat, the COWS Counter-Racist Yoga Retreat for Toronto, May 21 through May 24th, sold out, overbooked. We will have more people at this retreat than we've had at any retreat before. I am a little nervous about that. If things go awry and there is name-calling, grappling north of the border, the one thing that I am super excited about with this retreat, this will be the first time that we are doing a retreat in a city where there are a number of COWS listeners. And to be doing that, we're not even in the United States, so-called. So if things should go awry, I at least know if I can get to a skillet, I can fight them off, jump out the back window, see if I can bike or get an Uber to one of the COWS listeners' residence and see if they will let me camp out in their garage or back porch until my flight back to Seattle is valid. But we should have lots of resources, folks there to help out with where to go, what to do. Super excited about being in Toronto this spring. Yoga every day, plant-based meals. I'm hoping the weather cooperates. We can go outside for a little bit, but coming to Toronto with children, no less. Multiple children, no less. Exciting times. In addition, spring already ready to roll for this spring in Toronto. When we were in Florida, I was thinking of which retreats we could possibly do for the year. I wanted to try to do three, and I was thinking of locations. Toronto was one. I thought that, you know, might be feasible, even though I wasn't sure if people would be willing to, you know, travel across the border and get a passport and everything. They were. The other retreat idea that I had while we were in Florida, Washington, D.C. I said it is certainly not possible for Gus T. to go back to Virginia. Never, ever again. So for the people that are in Virginia, this is about as close as Gus T. is willing to get to a return to Virginia. Not even willing to fly into the state of Virginia. Coon man. But Washington, D.C., we can do Washington, D.C., affectionately known as Banneker City. And what I said, I can tell you exactly the plan as this germinated in Florida while we were at the retreat at the end of the year. I said, wow, Washington, D.C. Oh, wow, they got that Rosa Parks exhibit at the Library of Congress. We could go check that out, see her yoga mat and, you know, what all they have on display. And then we're at the Library of Congress. We could go see what books they have. We could research the so-called race riot that happened in Washington, D.C. in 1919 and lots of things. I mean, it's the Library of Congress. I said, then we're in Washington, D.C. We could go, you know, see where Dr. Welsing's house is. We could perhaps rendezvous with some of her students. I believe Sabrina Johnson, she's been a guest on the program. I believe she resides in the D.C. area. We could meet with some of her students, perhaps, and review some of the lectures. I said, my goodness, the National Museum of African American History and Culture is there. We could go make a visit. In fact, I even made a call, made a reservation, got a group reservation booked already. For this summer, but it was endless. Like, it was so many. I wanted to try to stick to the format, the same format that we'll have in Toronto of 4-day format, Thursday through Sunday. Solid enough time that we can eat together, do some yoga, have fun, do some counter-racism discussion, and not too long, you know, where we start to squabble and bicker. People got other things to do as well. So long enough that we can hang out, but not too long. I said, there's so much to do in Washington, D.C. We could be there for like weeks and not do everything. At minimum, we should make this 5 days. It's summertime. We should make this 5 days. So tentatively, unless folks say that they think it would be impossible to get, you know, these specific dates off or to do 5 days, tentatively looking at August 5th, which is a Wednesday, through August 9th, which is a Sunday. That would be 5 days, 4 nights in the nation's capital. And it's election season. That was the other thing I was thinking, like, wow, I have been to D.C. before. I grew up, I lived in Virginia. I've been to D.C. many times. I'm not sure I've been to Washington, D.C. in the summertime during election season. That is probably a little bit different of a feel, atmosphere to be in D.C. at that particular time. So lots of reasons, lots of things that I could think of to do. Primary reason we would be there, though, is retreat, plant-based meals, same thing. It would still be a retreat. So this is relaxation, counter-racist conversation, plant-based meals, relax, nourishing. That is the primary reason. But since we are in D.C., we could take, you know, if we're there for 5 days, we could take a couple field trips. We could take a little short field trip to the Library of Congress, short field trip to the African American Museum. Someone had mentioned going out to do yoga in the park, like short field trip, and then come back inside and rest, eat some great food, all of that. Enjoy. DC is a little bit humid in the summertime. I am very, very aware, having grown up in the mid-Atlantic region and even further south, I am very aware of the, I would call it, hostile humidity in that region in the summertime. So we absolutely have to get a residence with air conditioning. Speaking of residence, there are a very limited number of locations that could house, I'll say, like more than 10 people for a retreat, where we wouldn't have to have like 5 people or more staying in a room. So if people are serious about this, we could do it for the same price that we're doing the Toronto retreat, which is, or actually it would be $680 would be the price for DC. Toronto was $660, sold out. So $680 for 5 days, 4 nights, Washington, DC. That is a Wednesday through a Sunday, August 5th through the 9th. The deadline to register, April 18th. I would have made it sooner had I known that there are such few spots in DC that could house people. That's what I've said from the very beginning when we started doing these events last year. I said, wow, it is really hard to find locations, especially, I mean, if you narrow it to black owned, like, woof. It can be nigh impossible, but even still, it is really difficult to find locations. That is still the case. So if people are interested, deadline is April 18th. If folks think this is something they would like to pursue, Washington, D.C. for the summertime, deadline, the deposit would be $400, same way we did for Toronto. Hopefully we could make that happen. Would I think be fun? Like we could do counter-racist experiments. I was even thinking about that today, like, wow, we could it could even be something small, like just questions. Going to the museum, I don't know if people have been before or not, but to be able to go to the museum and think of a question, see if you can ask permission to ask people a question about something related to racism, white supremacy, like lots of opportunities for experiments and lots of things. Like I said, going by Dr. Welsing's residence, Washington, D.C., counter-racist yoga retreat for this summer. Yeah, if you have questions or details, I sent out an email earlier in the week. It is posted. All of the information is posted on my blog, racism-notes.blogspot.com. All of the details are there. If you have questions or need more information, feel free to share. We'll be able to, I guess, advertise or promote from Toronto once we get there and hang out if folks have a good time. And the food's delish. They enjoy the yoga and what have you. The weather cooperates. We're able to get outside a little bit. You can say, hey, in fact, if we have a good time, Toronto might be one that we have to look at as a permanent location. I'm always ecstatic. It is super nice to know that there are COWS listeners in the area where we are going to visit, who are eager to support. Just for example, we have never done a retreat thus far, Virginia, Florida, where there were COWS listeners, plural, who volunteered. Oh, do you need a ride from the airport? We are there. Oh, yeah, Toronto. Things work out well, might have to be looked at as one of our permanent locations for COWS retreats. Global system of racism. That is one thing I would echo over and over. System of white supremacy. It is not something that is isolated to Wuhan, South Africa, Alabama, Georgia. It is not just a tiny problem in these few little spots here and there. If we could just all get to Alaska, it would be rural. We'd have to get a plane to get to the DMV. No racism. That is not true at all. Global system of white supremacy racism. That is super, super important to remember at all times. Global system of racism. COWS listeners in Toronto. In fact, I'd been thinking a lot like, wow, we have a lot of COWS listeners in London. Mr. Fox posting all of that YouTube content. That's how a lot of folks found the COWS. Do we have enough COWS listeners to do a retreat in London? You all can let me know. I was thinking about that today. Global system. Let's see. Other information to share. The coronavirus. Speaking of global system, frequently when discussing white supremacy racism as a global system, I've heard many folks say that China is not subject to white supremacy racism. Mr. Fuller has a great sound clip where he's talking to a victim who makes that point explicitly. I hear it regularly that they are not subject to white supremacy racism. No way, no how. This right here, the so-called Wuhan coronavirus, is a phenomenal illustration. Now, I said yesterday, more people die from the flu per year than have died from the so-called Wuhan coronavirus thus far. Now, I looked again today just to verify, less than 5,000 reported deaths from the so-called coronavirus thus far. Typically, or at least for the 2019-2020 season, it's reported that there have been approximately 15,000 deaths. That's 3-to-1 ratio. I don't see an epidemic about, my gosh, the flu. Well, in fact, there was a gentleman out right here at the drugstore, and he said, I can't give away flu shots. You'd have to pay people to come take them. 15,000 people have died. I could be an error. I'm not a doctor. That's the report that I saw. 15,000 from the flu. Another COWS listeners pointed that out as well. Looks like more people die from the flu than just the Wuhan coronavirus. They're talking about China. They have shut factories down and quarantine. If you've gone to China, wow, all for this? Have you ever seen a response like this for an outbreak of any type of disease, epidemic for the United States or any other white dominated country? When I say white dominated, I mean in terms of population. This is a country that is known to have a high population of whites in relation to non-white people. I cannot. These type of quarantines where it's, we're not issuing any visas to any dark people from, boom. Matter of fact, the list, they gave out a list of countries of danger. If you travel to these regions, and their list of countries was China, Iran, Italy, South Korea. Three of those are areas that have a lot of individuals classified as non-white, and the other ones, Italy, the other one, singular. If you recall, Lothrop Stoddard, his name has been mentioned a lot this week. Madison Grant, if you remember some of the white nationalist literature from the early 20th century, they would have names. They would have that hierarchy of whites. The Swedes, they would be up high. All that talk about the Nords, the Alpine, the palest of the pale. And then further down the Sarthia, they call them the Meds, the Italia. These are, you know, kind of swarthy whites. In the book that we're reading right now, they'd be the ethnic whites. So you got these swarthy whites and non-white countries. They're the only ones that are quarantined. They're on the icky list. You got the cooties. You came from one of these regions? Uh-oh. You got a quarantine. Get out of here. Can't hang out with you. Mm-mm. White people can fall and die from all kinds of things. Eh. Excellent illustration in my view. Anybody who says China is not subject to racism, white supremacy, if all it takes is a few sneezes and whammo, we got to reevaluate everything. Whole economy is shut down. No, I don't want to hear any more about China is not subject to white supremacy, racism. Sad, but brilliant illustration right here. Global system of racism in effect. Next. Wow, black self-respect. We just had Black History Month. Dr. Frances Cress Welsing, her birthday is coming up. Birthday is coming up this month. Dr. Frances Cress Welsing, black self-respect. She talked about that all the time. I didn't play the audio segment. I could have. Spike Lee, victim of racism. Legendary filmmaker. Won an Oscar recently. Thomas in New York talks about white validation. Mr. Lee has had a major kerfuffle with James Dolan, suspected race soldier. He owns the New York Knicks professional basketball team. Spike Lee has been going, attending Knickerbocker games for years, decades. They got video footage of him going way, way back. Him sitting front row, shouting at black basketball players from the opposing team. Shouting, yelling, cheering on the New York Knicks. Good or bad, he's been right there, front row, center court. I think he's probably the most well-known Knickerbocker fan that I can think of. So he's had a kerfuffle with the owner of the Knicks, Mr. Dolan, and it became big news this week. Apparently, Spike Lee, he had been using a certain entrance and exit to the facility, and they got security and said, no way, we do not allow niggers to use this exit. You're using the employee exit, and we want you to use the exit over here. And Spike Lee reported that they told him, in fact, we want you to go outside and re-enter the building through a different door, you know, because you've used the wrong door. Got to have your correct papers. We don't allow any niggers to just, you know, roam around here willy-nilly. So he was, you know, not pleased. So he didn't go outside, but they ushered him to a seat a different way. And he came on to many different platforms to report that this happened, that he was not pleased. He was still wearing a substantial amount of New York Knicks paraphernalia, like Knickerbocker hats and glasses and T-shirts, clothing, that sort of thing, like a substantial amount of Knickerbocker gear. And they were asking him, you know, are you going to continue to attend Knicks games this season? And he said, no, not this season. I'm done for this season. He didn't say for life. He didn't say I'm never going to attend again. Just for this season, which I might add is about to end in less than a month. The season ends in April. So we're already a week through March. The season is about done. Anyway, so while he's, you know, they're asking him questions, they pause immediately and they get the statistics and they say, you know, we wanted to know how much money you spent for these tickets, because he's been front row for decades. And so they figure it out. They get his accountant on the line and they say, so for a pair of tickets, it's, I think they say about $3,000, and you've been going for 30 years. And so for one season, that adds up to about $300,000. So we do the math for about the 3 years that you, excuse me, 30 years that you've been going, approximately 30 years that Mr. Lee has been attending Knicks games. This amounts to approximately $10 million. And Spike Lee says, I look stupid spending all this money, you know, on this franchise. I thought, Dr. Frances Cress Welsing, black self-respect. I thought Neely Fuller Jr., worthy of great pity, because all of this was said while he was wearing a substantial amount of Knickerbocker paraphernalia. I'm a victim of racism. He's a victim of racism, too. I say all that to say, number one, that what I said when I posted all of this, he talked so passionately, Spike Lee, about attending Knicks games when he was a child and his father taking him to Knicks games. It's got to be a black male's fault. No count, feverish black males. But the things that we, how we use our time and energy with our offspring is vitally important. Those activities can have an indelible imprint on how we think, how we behave, memories that we have, those experiences. Sometimes we cherish, often we cherish them for a lifetime, good or bad. And we've had so many people, they talk about those experiences. If it's going to McDonald's, they call it get that happy meal, have that birthday party, or whatever. It for a lot of children, that is an experience. That becomes an experience, and particularly, I mean, any time around food and family, like, oh, man. Dr. Lathan, she talked about that, being in the car with her family and eating potato chips. She talked about that, how she still has a connection to potato chips because of that, being on road trips and things with her family and eating potato chips together. A lot of people have that from McDonald's, being in the car, munching on French fries, going down the road together. Getting together with the family to watch those sporting activities, that can be an indelible bond. That's how some people end up spending, you know, Thanksgiving holidays together, Christmas holidays together for decades, and then transfer that, and you end up doing that with your offspring, and it just goes on and on and on, as opposed to, wait a minute, I'm going to exercise maximum black self-respect. I have patronized this franchise for decades, more than a quarter century. That's longer than some of the Cavs listeners have been alive. That's longer than Justice has been alive. I patronized this franchise. I spent nearly $10 million here. This is how I'm going to be treated? I'm a Negro. I'm supposed to go through the back door. I didn't go through the correct. $10 million nigger. That's what William Roden says. I'm a $10 million nigger. I got to go through the back entrance to walk around. I can sit up front, but I got to walk around the back entrance. No problem. I will never set foot in Madison Square Garden again. I will never don a thread of Knickerbocker paraphernalia in life. That is exercising black self-respect. Like, I'm not going to participate at all. That's black self-respect. Changing behavior can be very, very, that's another thing I said too. It can be very, very hard to change behavior. If you've been doing this for 30 years, things we've been doing for a long time, sometimes it can be difficult to change those behaviors. That's why it's important. Try to start early with constructive behaviors. That's why we have 3 children coming to the counter-racist yoga retreat, and I think it'll be in the middle of the NBA playoffs. No basketball allowed at the yoga retreat. We have things, priorities. It would be totally different if all this was happening and there was no white supremacy racism. Fine, whatever. we could sit around and, you know, boo-hoo about the Knicks and all of that. You know, we got time to waste. That's not the case. We're in a system of white supremacy racism. If Lennon Lacy is a problem, black male lynched in North Carolina and nobody even knows his name, if that's serious, Caleb Schmidt in Canada, black 13-year-old, commits suicide because he was bullied by racists, if that's a serious problem, if that's more of a problem than the New York Knicks, well then, hey, same thing that moron has been saying. Sobriety would be best, and we don't need to participate in those sporting activities at all. Like, let's divest completely, because that stuff can be real addictive and like lifelong addictive in terms of time and energy. Even if it hadn't been $10 million invested in the franchise, even let's say they allowed him to come to the game for free, like his promotion. Matter of fact, they pay Drake to go to the games at the Raptors. That's his job, to come to sit in the front row and act a fool. They could do that. Let's even say they did that. It's still about time and energy. Like, is this the most important way for me to be investing my time and energy? I could have been doing another documentary film or anything, studying racism, white supremacy. No, I'm sitting out here at the game, rooting on the Knickerbockers, hoping they get a good draft pick. That's not important in a system of racism, white supremacy. That's not important at all. Be serious about serious things. And particularly if racism, white supremacy is going to be an issue, even with me sitting here, $10 million nigger, if that's all it comes down to, well then, oh yeah, yeah. Forget, I don't even want to be paid to sit up here. Like, you all can, you know, let's just get back to the business at hand, solving the problem. Folks have comments to share. You can take about 5 minutes. Share your questions, observations, suggestions. That way everybody has at least one chance to speak. If you know you have additional thoughts, you can mute your line, allow everyone their one opportunity, then you can return and speak more. If you know you're in a noisy environment, if you could please make sure you can move to kind of a quieter region, maybe. And then you can share your thoughts. Just helps if we do not have to compete with a lot of unnecessary background noise. For this one broadcast, I exclusively request if we could not use metaphors, if we could make an effort to be precise, mindful about our language, words that we choose to articulate our thoughts. Racists, they will regularly employ analogies, comparisons, metaphors to practice deception. They'll take two concepts and insist that they are identical. Frequently, this is not the case at all. Victims, myself included, we've been subjected to this misconduct for centuries. And many of us, we are still learning. As such, sometimes we don't have logic to articulate our views. And so we'll substitute and employ an analogy, comparison of some sort. Often this just invokes a lot more confusion. If we could be precise, specific, exact with what we want to say, that would be appreciated. I will prompt about the metaphors. Much obliged. The number again is 605-313-5164. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. If folks have thoughts, observations, audio segments, other news items that happened from the last week, *61 if you would like to participate. Folks who have a hand up, line should be open. Feel free to chime in. Well, first few folks, we'll put it that way. First few folks who dotted up. As I stated, always exciting to do retreats in locations where we have Cal's listeners. Let's see. B in Toronto, we'll start there. Did you have commentary?
Hi. Hi, guys.
Yes, ma'am.
Hi. Greetings to you, callers and listeners. B from Toronto, how are you doing?
Right poorly.
Understood. Same here in Canada. So, the reason I called in is I wanted to mention that I've been studying different terms as of late, and I'm not quite sure if this is already known or if I'm just finding this out now and am super floored about this particular meaning. So, I remember that oftentimes you ask the question, what does it mean to be white? So I decided to ask my question, what does it mean to be black? And decided to look into it further in terms of the origins of the term. And I came across a YouTube video, and I'm going to actually check it out further by actually seeing if I can get the book. But it's from the American Dictionary by Noah Webster of 1828, which is now known as the Webster Dictionary. And the term black means pale, bleached, to lighten up. And I thought that was very interesting because the way that the term is used now, it's for non-white people of African descent throughout the African diaspora. But it's quite interesting that in 1828, the term black meant pale, bleached, and to lighten up. so that the way that the terms are being used, black and white may actually be the same thing. White also being blank or blanco or blanca or blanche, meaning blank, of devoid of color. So I thought that was interesting and wanted to share as well. So I'd highly recommend, as you've mentioned also in past podcasts, terms are important, words are important. So definitely check the origins of those terms to use those terms effectively. Thank you, and I leave the line.
Much obliged to be in Toronto. I know a few of our listeners, a number of our listeners, even some of our guests have talked about some of the earlier definitions of the term black, what it means, some of the surprises that they found looking up that term. I encourage folks to do more exploring, especially in some of the law dictionaries, especially if you can get some of the older dictionaries to see what some of the earlier definitions are, that's been mentioned before, that can be quite revealing. I think it's mentioned regularly, investigating terms, what they mean, definitions, and asking people. Oh, and that much obliged be in Toronto. It was mentioned on an earlier broadcast. Someone asked about the term anti-black racism. The procedure that I recommend, in my view, that is best in following logic, ask the person that uses the term. That's when you really get understanding. One, because everybody doesn't mean the same thing when they use the term. And second, if you're asking about the usage of a term and somebody is guessing at the definition who didn't even use the term, you probably are not getting the most clarity about what the intention was as to why that word was selected, what that person's thought process was, because they're just guessing. With anti-black racism, that term was mentioned. I had not used the term. I have used it before, and I've heard other people use it, but it had not been used at that time. So just making sure people, or I would encourage them, and I think it would be more fruitful. That's a practice that I try to be in when people use terms that I don't understand. Even if it's a written article, I've done that too. I've emailed people and just said, I don't know what this term means. If I've had a suggestion sometimes about a better term to use that I think is more precise, is more accurate, I've done that as well. But try to directly address the person that's using the term. When I have used the term anti-black racism, I have used it to call specific attention sometimes to abuse, mistreatment that is directed specifically at individuals who are classified as black. This is not abuse, mistreatment at just any old non-white person. In fact, sometimes if you are not classified as black, this type of abuse is excluded. You are excluded from this sort of abuse. This type of abuse, mistreatment is reserved specifically for individuals classified as black. Those are times when I will use the term anti-black racism. And even then, a lot of times I will not use that term there. I'll just say explicitly what I just said, that this is specifically targeting black people. However, I am certain that's not what everybody means when they use the term anti-black racism. That's why I say it's best, I think, to ask the people that are using the term, ask them directly and see what they say when they use the term. Folks can let me know if that makes sense. That is logical. Let's see. Other folks who dialed in, if we have missed you thus far, if you have a hand up, commentary to share, proceed.
Can I be heard?
Greetings, retired firefighter.
Greetings, Gus. I am pretty much interested in the trip to Washington, D.C. I noticed you haven't mentioned about Mr. Fuller. Do you have or have you made any plans to get in contact with him as far as a part of the trip itself?
I am certainly going to try. I have not spoken with him as of yet, just because today was the first time that I had announced it, and I'm not sure, you know, if we'll have enough people to go, if we have a robust number of people that are serious about attending. But if it seems like that is the case, and that, you know, we will in fact be going, absolutely. We'll be chatting it up with him to see if we can, how shall I say, like if it's, I guess I'll say now, I don't think it could be 18 people in Washington, D.C. It's 18 in Toronto. I don't think they have a space that would be adequate to contain that many people. So it would probably be max 14, I would think, which is what it was supposed to be in Toronto. But, you know, oh, well, they have larger space there. So it would probably be 14 max, even if it was 14. I don't know if I would want to hang out in Mr. Fuller's house with 14 people.
I wasn't even referring to meeting him at his house. Maybe, you know, it's some place where, you know, he could meet us at or something like that. Just wonder.
Yeah, I have not.
Anything that I can do to help with that, I'll be willing to participate in it as far as getting in contact with him and asking him myself. His number is pretty much public, you know, as far as that concerned. I'm just thinking about the idea of it.
Right. Once we get a little bit further along and it, you know, starts to take shape, if it's going to happen, I'll reach out and see. And even the logistics about that, you know, if that's something that he would be interested in, and if so, how would be the best way to make that happen, to give kind of a short, you know, howdy, we're here, it's been nice, maybe we could take a picture and give him some sweet potato pie and keep it pushing. But yeah, that's once it seems like this is a yay or a nay, we'll see if he would be down to doing a little very brief, maybe meet and greet type thing.
Yes. Included, I was sent the article on Mr. Lee, and I would just say to Mr. Lee and his comments and interest VGQ, no one has been involved into quote unquote sport activity more than I have during my lifetime, but I am not a fan of any particular sport or team or anything of that nature. I've been involved directly, meaning coaching, and I use it as a platform. So when someone asks me what's my favorite team, it's wherever I'm working at. As far as that concerned, as far as what I favor, although it goes across the realm of wherever our young people are at, I'm for it. As far as on the high school level, for the most part, the professional means that I've coached, I don't know how many untold athletes who have played professional sports, but that doesn't mean anything to me at all. I am not even remotely interested into being something called a fan, which is short for fanatic in itself, and we just go from there, you know, with anything that is not going to make sense at all. And for the most part, as far as going to the college games, they even invite the high school coaches to go for free, and I would refuse to go because of that. If I was interested in watching a game, I'll watch it on television. That's the best seat in the house as far as that concerned. But nevertheless, next and last subject, Mr. Clark would be is supposed to be speaking Monday. I talked with him today, texting today anyway. And he's supposed to be speaking on some subject he is vying for a Miami-Dade County Commissioner seat down here. And in turn, he is speaking, he'll be on a panel Monday. And the subject matter is, caution, relationships. It's some kind of antiquated term that begins with the word relationships. And I said, well, I may show up to just observe. Normally in a panel-like environment, it's geared for arguing and debating, which I, for the most part, find almost nothing constructive about it. But nevertheless, I may go by just to observe the event itself. And that's all I have to say. Thank you for listening.
Much obliged, retired firefighter. If Mr. Clark can get through next week without any bickering, squabbling, name-calling, bloodshed, fisticuffs, man, he will have my admiration. I wish him the best and hope it goes well. You all can report back and let us know. Well, I guess if you attend or not, I guess you can report back and let us know.
Yeah, he's good at it. He's good at it. He's a very witty person. He can think very quickly.
Right on. Well, you do your best, Mr. Clark. We'll be thinking, praying for you next week. Number again, 605-313-5164, the code 564-943-pound. Press star 61 if you would like to participate. Make sure I get this in as well. We had a number of folks, Ivy, others who were asking about different archives. One person was posting about the Dreams for My Father, President Obama's autobiography. And that's like 2012 in the archives. And I said, I'm going back and doing my archive restoration. I think we got all of 2016 corrected, working on 2015 currently. I went back even out of order, so to speak, and got Lacey Schwartz, that episode posted. This is a non-white female cowbell. She has one white parent, one non-white parent. Said out of order because she was on the program like November 2014. She did the documentary film Little White Lies, probably on Netflix now. It came on PBS, and it's about her white mom lying to her. She had an affair with a black male, and she lied to her. Lacey Schwartz told her she had a skin condition and all this. The film is about her finding all this out. Anyway, Lacey Schwartz, she lied when she was on the program. I'm not calling her a liar, but she lied. There is not pussyfooting. That is what I recall. I added that back to the archive, and I put an addendum in the description. She lied. I was not able to see that documentary film until about, I don't know, 4 or 5 months after she was a guest on the program. This was not a widely released documentary. It's not like this was at every local theater, and it was not released on PBS until a few months after she was a guest on the program. They had some limited screenings in certain cities, and if you listen to the archive, some of the Cow's listeners had actually seen the film. But specifically, she was saying, Lacey Schwartz, that when she was growing up, people just accepted that she was white. That was what her mom told her, white mom, racist, no suspect, that she was white. And she had this skin condition, was why she was a little bit darker. And she said that the white people that she lived around, they just accepted her as white, and this wasn't an issue. And I said, there is no way. White people are not confused about, you know, who is white and who is not white. There's no way. And if you see an image of her, her picture is in the description. You can see it if you Google Lacey Schwartz, this documentary, you'll see her. There is no way someone classified as white would see her and, so you're not a coon. You are classified as white. Absolutely not. And white people in the documentary, they said, oh, yeah, we just thought, you know, you had, you know, some black uncle or whatever it is, or blah, blah, blah. But they made a number of comments. That is exactly what I thought. We didn't think you were white, and we just didn't tell you. And she could have just said that on the program. It's something that bothered me. There's no reason to lie in the system of racism, white supremacy. Racists require us to do a lot of lying. There's no reason to lie about that aspect of the film. But she was not honest at all. And I added that as an addendum. All you have to do is listen to the program and then go watch the documentary. Either or. You can watch the documentary first and then go listen to the program flagrant. But you can make now that task is easy because that was one of the archives that got disrupted. It has been republished. So it is available unedited. You can download it. November 2014, Lacey Schwartz. Some of you all were present for that broadcast, but it is back in the archives now. So you can check it out in its entirety. Other folks who are with us, if we have missed you so far, *61, if you have comments, questions to share.
Well, hi. Hi, call listeners and the host, Gus. I wanted to request the cows with the death of Black America with Ray Rihanna, comparing the plantation with the concentration camps. So that's a particular Kyle's episode that I've been searching all over for, and I can't seem to find it. So that's what I wanted to request. Could that happen, Gus?
Which program is this that you're looking for again?
The Death of Black America. The Death of Black America. Comparing the plantation with the concentration camps with also Ray Rihanna.
Death of Black America. Yes. We'll see if I can go back to find where that one is archived.
Okay. And then this is Victor from Toronto. So I kind of want to echo with the first caller was talking about when she was trying to define words in a codified manner and asking herself questions, ask myself questions, what it is to be Black in a world system of white supremacy, racism. And I can tell you, I get vigorously mistreated and subjugated. And every time I want to let people know what's happening, they tend to minimize what I'm saying. They tend to say things like, oh, maybe you are wrong and maybe you're taking it personal, you know, maybe you should focus on yourself. And it gets really, really frustrating when the people who practice racism, who are classified as white, deny that racism exists, or they minimize the effects of racism on victims like me. And it causes a lot of stress, a lot of anxiety. I feel as if I'm trapped. And they're always trying to find some way of how to blame the victim. And you know, so when I read Mr. Fuller's book, the United Independent Compensatory Code System concept, that book provides me a tool. You know, Mr. Fuller always says words are tools. So I appreciate it, Gus, when you made it clear what is anti-Black racism, because I never considered that you could be using the term anti-Black racism to address people who are actually Black or who are from the non-white family. So so that kind of makes sense. Just that from my understanding, what racism is, the only form of racism is white supremacy, and white supremacy is racism, and racism is white supremacy is white supremacy is racism and white supremacy is racism. I'm sorry if I'm screwing that up. I'm just really nervous. I'm just trying to think about what I'm going to say. And race is racism. If any of the listeners heard what I just said and I said it wrong, please correct me. So that's the only form that I know the only form of racism is white supremacy. So when someone says white racism, that doesn't make any sense to me because I understand that there's only one form of racism. So that's when you made it clear that you said anti-black racism, you're talking about black people, the racism that black people experience. But a lot of white people see racism as something that happens to everyone. But racism is a power relations. It has to have the power to tell people what to do, and you can't tell them what to do. And they can mistreat you perpetually in all forms of all areas of people activity, law, labor, politics, sex, religion, education, entertainment, sex and war. And you're powerless to do anything because you're from the group that has inferior power. And from my understanding, the white supremacists have superior power. Non-white people are not powerless. We just have less power. So, you know, this is when I read Mr. Fuller's book, and it helps me to codify my language and understand how to use words as tools. I have a question, though, for the Cal listeners. I've heard this term called xenophobia. I really dislike that word because it just sounds like another word to cloak white supremacy racism. Because from my understanding, the term xenophobia is something that's foreign. But every time when they refer to a non-white person, they're always referring to them as a foreigner or something that's not, you know, that's not from the area where it's from. So I think xenophobia is just another word to cloak racism. Anyway, anybody could respond to my comment and let me know if that makes any sense. I'll mute my line.
Much obliged, caller in Toronto or caller in Canada. Global system of white supremacy racism. Death of Black America, Aaron Rea, E-R-A-N-R-E-Y-A. He was on the broadcast in August of 2011. I will link it so that people can download it and make sure that one is back in the archives. Dr. Cambon wanted him to be a guest on the program way back when. It's been 9 years. 9 years. Aaron Rea. Let's see. Words are important. They will use a lot of those types of terms to obfuscate from talking directly about white supremacy racism. I think xenophobia was one of the terms used in the segment where they were talking about the so-called coronavirus and the racism, white supremacy being perpetuated around this. And I think they didn't say white supremacy racism. They said xenophobia. Very common. Let's see. Number again, 605-313-5164, the code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Other folks.
Oh, sorry, Gus. I wanted to ask you, sorry to interrupt, where can I find that link? Because sometimes I have trouble finding links.
I was going to post it online. Do you follow on Facebook?
Oh, so it's going to be on the Facebook.
Will that work?
Oh, okay, sure. Just that sometime when I go to find links, I spend a long time trying to look for the link and then I can't find it. So
happens to the best of us. I feel your frustration, sir. I'll try to make it.
Thank you.
very direct, so you don't have to waste time and energy. Talk about that all the time, making sure we use our time and energy in an efficient manner. Let's see.
Thank you.
Much obliged. Much obliged. Other folks who dialed in, if you have observations, questions, suggestions, line should be open. Feel free.
May I be heard?
Yes, sir. Greetings, caller in Florida.
Yes, sir. Thank you very much, sir. Greetings to guests, the hosts, the listeners, and callers. I don't think I spoke on this a couple of weeks ago, but it has something to do with the president, and he made a comment about suspected racist Brad Pitt making a comment, I guess, at an award show about the impeachment hearings. And he used the term wise guy. Oh, isn't he a wise guy? And the reason I'm mentioning that was, I'm like, wait a minute, that's the best you got? Like, that was my reaction. Like, I'm not, you know, trying to encourage name calling, but when he was talking about LeBron James, he said it was stupid, and Don Lemon is stupid, and NFL players are SOBs. Baltimore rat infested. I mean, clearly, way more malicious and racist when it comes to black people. That was my first one. And the next is, there was, I think within the last 2 weeks, two black children, I think a 6-year-old and a 7-year-old, was put in handcuffs at two different elementary schools down here in Florida. It just goes to show that we are criminalized at an early age and treated horribly. And the audio segment about the 13-year-old black male, I believe, how he was responding to racism physically like that, and the school didn't see it. I don't know if anybody else seemed to conclude with the school not really punishing and addressing the racism. I guess they use the term bullying practiced by the white students. And that's definitely how they have their code set up to get out into society, to find multiple ways, creative ways to mistreat black people. So if in the event they respond, we have some white people. When I say we, speaking in, they do things. They have a means of support to reward the racist behavior that they practice. And the non-white people who want, you know, we want to be accepted. We want justice. We just want things to be correct. We're not aware of these horrible acts, racist acts that are being practiced. So him to, you know, respond, I think she said he knocked the person's teeth out. And I think that was an interesting detail as well, but not really speaking to his pain and victimization. My last one is on the, I believe that is the coronavirus and the non-white people, so-called Asians. I think the lady was saying that, I guess the metaphor under the radar was used for so long up until now, how, you know, all of a sudden people are afraid, I guess, to walk next to people who are Chinese, Asian, or anything like that. And it's just profound, the power and the use of resources that white people can display with the news, entertainment, and they've been doing that for decades, centuries, just in media like cartoons, Disney, Warner Brothers, making these racist, stereotypical cartoons and images. I think they mentioned images being made as stereotypes. People are non-white diseased and you don't want to be around them, that contaminates the mind. And I think, in my opinion, they kept the same strategy to use information resources to show multiple people that, hey, you want to watch out for these people. And then I agree with the term xenophobia, using terms like that instead of saying white supremacy. Well, it's xenophobia. You know, we just want to put it out there that people are, seem like they're fearful of Chinese people. You know, don't use racism when you have white people who are responsible for putting these images out there and promoting the stories. See, so that people will react with those kinds of emotions. Oh, well, I'm not racist. I just don't want to get sick. See, they're highly skilled, but that's all I wanted to say. Thanks for allowing me to speak.
Much obliged, caller in Florida. Metaphors, incredibly important under the radar that was used. And that's, at least I think, important because that's a radar that's like military vernacular. Like, we're talking under the radar. That's the sort of content like, well, if you're under the radar, meaning that, you know, we can't see you to target you in a racial context, because that's what they were talking about. Who is on the radar? Who is being targeted?
Yeah.
Just put that there rhetorically. But yeah, metaphor being used. And like that generally is military vernacular, military type metaphor. You know, if we're going to bomb somebody, you know, we got the radar lined. Okay, we're dropping our missiles, and unless I'm misinformed. Other folks, if we have missed you totally, we're encroaching on the 30-minute mark. So please do not wait until the last few moments. If you think you have comments, questions, observations you would like to share, go ahead, get a hand up if you have thoughts to offer. 605-313-5164, the code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate.
Can I be heard?
Greetings, Imhan DC.
I'm pulling over.
Right on. No driving while we're on the phone. That's right. Thank you. Public service announcements continue. No driving while on the phone. Race soldiers will look for any reason to terrorize black people. Absolutely. PSAs abound on the cows.
Truly. Yes, sir. So I'm pulled over now. I wanted to say a few things. First, about the non-white people, the countries that non-white people are in have been labeled to have different diseases. One of the times, the time previous to this that I went to Ghana, the time previous to this, while I was in Ghana, they announced the Ebola virus was in Africa. And this is, I was in Ghana for almost 4 months, and it was towards the last month or so, or something like that, they announced Ebola in this country, and then this country, and then this country, and it was all over beside Ghana. And I was going to leave Ghana to go to a few of the neighboring countries, but then I couldn't leave Ghana because I didn't know if I'd make it back into America with this new Ebola virus. Anyway, I also wanted to say I am American. You've asked me for a definition, and I don't make up definitions. You know, I use definitions that already exist. So an American is a person who has a certain amount of ancestry of people in America before white people came to America. there's a percentage of ancestry, but I haven't quantified that percentage. Also, I wanted to say I'm asked, or it's been asked, why do I keep talking about chemtrails or chemical dumpings, aerial chemical dumpings? Why do I keep talking about that when there's other things to talk about? The reason is because out of everything that I've studied, all the experiences I've had, I've come up with a number of things that are crucial to ending white supremacy. Chemtrails is one of the things that I've come up with that is crucial to ending white supremacy. And I've done a lot of reading. I've lived on a college campus most of my life, on or around a college campus. I was in my mother's stomach while she was in college. I've met a lot of speakers. I've heard of a lot of theories. I've read a lot of books. And the words that I choose, I know that words are important, and that there's only so much time that I have. And so I choose the words that I choose for a reason, and there's a reason I speak about chemtrails. But I think it's one of the most important things that we need to focus on. White people need that for their survival. We need white people to stop white supremacy, and white people need chemtrails in order to survive in the areas that black people live in. They even put it in the movies now. You know, like if you see, if there's a movie about anything, they can't, or they have a hard time canceling out the chemtrails from the sky. So you'll see period movies from the medieval period, and it still have chemtrails in the sky. Or you even see cartoons, and they put it in cartoons so that you can get used to it. It's important to their overall plan, and it's something else is supposed to come after chemtrails. That's what I'm trying to stop it at this point. But we need the sun, as that's evident. The other thing is, I think that people might be wondering, why do I ask white people, where are they from? I ask them because I don't know where they're from, but white people know where they're from. And the other thing is, I also say that white people have to leave America, Africa, Australia, and all of the places that they've invaded. And that's important because they would not be able to do certain crimes against us. And I know, Mr. Gus, you disagreed with a statement that I made that white people wouldn't be able to have the same type of internet presence. And I was referring to Area 8. And I still say they wouldn't have the same internet presence. If we took them out of America, they would not be able to entice us with the things that they say. The reason why the things that white people say or do, or even the pornography, the reason why any of that's enticing is because black Americans are involved. Seriously. And if we're not involved, then it's not interesting. I'm sure people are going to disagree with me. But either way, if white people are not here in America and they're not in Africa and they're not in Australia and the other places that they've invaded, then again, I say they would not have the same internet presence. They would not be able to murder us at the same rate. And I think that people need to be more in unison with saying that white people must leave all of these areas. And I also want to point out that there hasn't been a case yet where white people have left, all the white people have left a single country, you know, for people to say that, well, here's an example where white people left this place and then, you know, it's still all bad. They haven't left, not a country, a continent. There's not a continent that white people have left since they've come. But if they leave the continent, then that will go a big way to solving white supremacy. Thank you.
Much obliged, Imhan Dc. I saw this week, it was the New York Times, I believe. This is related to Soho Wuhan coronavirus as well. They had an image and it said it was something to the effect of how like powerful white people. They use different terminology, but it was something to the effect of how powerful white people are thinking of responding to the coronavirus. And it just had like that written as a rhetorical question, one line. And the image, that was most of it. The image with this article, it was an image of the planet Earth and a rocket leaving the planet. That was this week. New York Times, I believe. I'll see if I can dig out the report and I will share. But yeah, global system. We even had folks said known universe. Very important, Mr. Fuller, using that terminology, not thinking of racism as, you know, something very limited and small, but force that dominates the known universe.
Can I be heard?
Thomas in New York. Yes, sir.
I believe they just created the Space Force. You know, and Elon Musk putting up 42,000 satellites all around the Earth to try to provide some type of free wireless connection, high speed for everyone. Yeah, I believe he's going to have 12,000 up by June, putting up 60 every week. You can see them. It's like the space rocket goes up and they just come out the back, 60 of them, just looking around, and they follow each other in a sequence, and then they scatter out. Each, you know, each one's going to cover a certain amount of area. Just, they're doing a lot of stuff up there. They haven't destroyed the Earth enough. Let's go destroy somewhere else. But Gus, I don't know, man. If I'm anywhere dealing with the coronavirus outbreak, I would probably want to be in the United States. I certainly wouldn't want to be in Brazil or Cuba, man. They got way too many black people there. I don't want to be there. Coronavirus discrimination. Chinese people being called corona. I know the Mexican people are happy. Like, finally, we ain't going to be called coronas. But, man, poor Chinese people. We're so discriminated against. Over 1,000 homeless people died last year in Los Angeles. And they conjured up $8 billion to fight a form of the common cold or coronavirus. Like, are you serious? This isn't... Come on. Jesse Smollett. Who would risk their job to try to cover that up? I mean, you know, talk about being foolish. Kim Fox, like every other black politician and law enforcement, is being used to fit an agenda. She's decided to come into the state office in a state with Chicago with thousands of unsolved murders. And what she does is she goes after R. Kelly, you know, and decides not to prosecute Jussie Smollett. And, you know, who falsely made up a story about racism that, to me, is dangerous for all black people because we it's hard for us to prove racism. Then she illegally and unconstitutionally decides she's going to support Chicago as a sanctuary city, allowing thousands of, I guess you would have to call them criminals, to walk freely and work illegally in a city where black people can't get a job. Unbelievable. I mean, like, hey, I have no pity on her. I hope she loses. The little black girl, that was very interesting, and I kind of feel that way, too, when I look at some of the incidents of racism. I say, man, that wasn't that long ago. It was like, you know, she's like, man, my grandmother's not even that old. Like, it's very interesting how, you know, how recent some of the debauchery white people have done. I mean, they're still bad, but when they were allowed to be unchecked by other white people and could do what they wanted to do, how violent they were, and how sterile they were at the environment. The ID, that's all part of surveillance capitalism. I mean, come on. Y'all picked it out. The World Trade Center fell in 2001. If this was that important, this thing would have been implemented in 2002. White people don't mess around with important things. This was an ongoing plan. It has an RFID chip inside of the card as well. So does your credit cards, but so does the new passport as well. Has the RFID chip inside of it, all for surveillance. They're going to have city ID soon in New York, which will be very similar to that. It'll give residents privileges and amenities of the city that I guess other people can't get. All part of, like I said, surveillance capitalism and setting up all these multiple blockchains. It's going to be moving toward the future. I'm moving toward a cashless society. It's all in there. The Knicks in New York, my stepfather said when he was young, and he was a basketball player, but not a professional. When he was young, and the Knicks decided they were going to get play more black people, I think they had a team with four black people on it, that the paper put the New York Knickerbockers on the front page, or on the back page with a sports page. Spike, the Knickerbockers and the Los Angeles Makers, unbelievable. But Spike posted into the celebrity entrance, but was allowed to enter the employee entrance for 28 years. And 28 years and $10 million later, the white supremacists decided they were going to follow procedure and say, no, you cannot enter that entrance. You have to enter this entrance. And that's just how white people do. He said he's not going. He said he was not going to talk about it. But the owner, who does like white people, so walks over to him at halftime, puts his hand out, shakes his hand, and says, you know, listen, man, that's the new procedure. You better follow it. And, he was giving his grievances about the new procedure. And either way, the Knicks put it out the next day, like, hey, they showed the handshakes there. Hey, him and Dolan made up and everything is cool. And he wanted to come out and say, hey, that's all a lie. I was standing up for myself. And they asked him, would you want to come back to this garden? No, not this season, next season. I'm like, man, VGQ, but man, that's not black self-respect like that. You spent $10 million to be treated like that. And then he even mentioned what happened to Charles Oakley last year, which was, he was a player for them and they treated him like that. I think you mentioned that on the show before, Gus. Charles Oakley, I would not be going back there, Radio City, Beacon, Chicago, LA Forum. This dude owns a lot of stuff. I wouldn't be going to none of that stuff he owns. That's just how I feel. And in fact, they asked him if he would go to Brooklyn next, and he said, "Nah, I can't do it." I mean, you could probably get paid like Drake to sit there and build their brand. The Knicks is worth $3.5 billion. You helped build that, and you paid for it. Like, not using logic. I mean, my logic, Gus.
Did you think Justin Smollett, might have mispronounced his name, did you think he should have been prosecuted in Chicago?
For sure. Absolutely. For making up a false police report. For that, I couldn't do that and get away with it. You couldn't either.
Probably true. Probably true. Let's see. I was checking. Again, if you are with us and you have comments to share, do not wait until the last minute. Number is 605-313-5164. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Please do not wait till the last moment if you have questions, observations. I'm just going through the New York Times. I was checking online, and this is an article I found. This is from the op-ed of the New York Times. This is from 2016, ancient history, I know. I recalled a moment from my childhood in Hawaii. I was just writing about Hawaii today. That is crazy. I have to pause. Why was I writing about Hawaii today? I walked to get blueberries today. I was going to go get blueberries, come back, do yoga, and then get ready to the program, do the program. So I go to get blueberries. They had organic blueberries, 18 ounces. That's a little more than a pound, on sale for $3.99. Outrageous. I tried to get as many as I could. So I went to get blueberries, and I was coming back right as I'm almost at my residence. It begins raining. It's springtime here, so I mean, it's not frigid. It's not summer either, but I mean, you know, it's not terrible. And I'm right basically in front of my residence. So as opposed to going into the house, I turn and I look and I'm like, oh, there's a rainbow. And I stop and I'm like, whoa, there's a double rainbow. And this takes me back because in Hawaii, they would have double rainbows all the time. I don't know this. I'm ignorant, greatly retarded. So I don't know the full science of how the rainbow process develops after it rains. But in Hawaii, this would be like a daily thing. You have double rainbows all the time. And in fact, it was such a wacky experience. It started raining. The sun was out. And it was a double rainbow. All of that used to be daily experience in Hawaii. Hawaii is one of the few other places that I have been on the planet where it will rain with the sun out regularly. And you will have double rainbows regularly. But that did happen today in Seattle. I even took a picture. I posted it. I was so flabbergasted for the moment. Anyway, so report again reads, I recalled a moment from my childhood in Hawaii. One of my best friends, Dominic, was white. He was from a big family, and being at his house was like stepping into an 80s sitcom. I was over there all the time. Dominic's dad was my mom's boss on the Air Force base. But one day when I asked my mom if I could go to Dominic's, she said no. She said the same thing the next time I asked, and the next. After a few weeks, I gave up. It wasn't until I was an adult that I heard the story. Dominic's family was having a party. We kids were probably in front of the Nintendo or running around the yard. The parents were inside talking about the New York Knicks' full name, the Knickerbockers. Their real name should be the New York Knickerbockers. Dominic's mom said with a laugh. Got ahead of myself. My mother, the only black person at the party, gathered her things, found me, and told me it was time to go. Hear me some black self-respect. Dr. Francis Press Welsing, that's what you do as an attempted black parent. That's not let me hang out and laugh. Maybe they didn't mean that. Maybe they never heard that before. They were just trying to be funny. They were a little tired. They had one too many cognacs. No, let me collect my child. We are leaving. We are never, ever coming back to this residence again. That's black self-respect. VGQ, absolutely. But that's black self-respect. I don't blame my mother for not explaining, but I would have benefited from knowing what had happened. I would add that. That is, talk about that all the time, talking with your children about racism, white supremacy. Now, that would be odd if the child didn't hear it, but if the child is going to continue to ask, you know, why can't I go to Dominic's? Man, I miss Dominic. That sure is my buddy Dominic's. We had so much fun at the party. Why can't we go? Well, okay. Grab a sit down. Have you heard the word nigger before? Yes, no, blah, blah, blah. And you go from there. You explain. And you just tell them exactly what happened. Racist jokes, big part of racism, white supremacy. You're going to hear lots of these over your, well, maybe you won't. It'll depend. But if you hang out with white people, racist jokes, blacks, and that's when you go right to Dr. Francis Cress Welsing. Black self-respect. Bravo. I'm going to post this article as well. But there's lots of them. If you Google New York Knickerbockers, you will get tons of them. You'll get this one, that one, tons. It'll go back for years where people have affectionately referred to Spike Lee's team as the New York Knickerbockers. Patrick Ewing rolling over in his grave. And yes, the incident with Charles Oakley, we talked about that. He's a black male, one of the former New York Knickerbockers from like the 1990s. He was actually on a team that went to the finals. And he came back, former player. Normally they're venerated. You know, you get a former player, they come back, they sit in the front row, they put the spotlight on them, and the crowd cheers. Maybe they show some highlights and all that. Oh, no, not with Charles Oakley. He comes to the game. Security, they come around. They get like 15 people, and they're shoving on him. They snatch him out. They get about 15 people and drag him out and put him in shackles and what had just totally disgraceful incident. This is, I think, within the last 2 years or so. But, yeah, this happened as well. Sister, and they asked Charles Oakley about the incident with Spike Lee. They asked him about that this week. And he said, metaphors. He didn't say a system of racism, white supremacy. He said, it's a plantation over there. And then he explained, metaphors. Talk about that on a regular basis. Charles Oakley has VGQ too, though, as well. Other folks dialed in, if you have comments, questions, observations, proceed. Especially if you have comments, observations, and we have not heard from you, do not wait until the last 5 minutes. Go ahead and get your hand up if you have comments to share. Other folks, if you dialed in, if you have additional questions, comments you want to add in, proceed.
Yeah, Gus.
Yes, sir.
Is Achon DC still there?
Emhon DC?
The Kyle's caller?
Yes, sir.
Hello, sir. I was wondering how could I find information on chemtrails?
Okay. Well, I'm going to have to email Mr. Gus. So I've read several articles, and to answer your questions as quick as possible, I'll have to email Mr. Gus what I found.
Okay, sir. Thank you.
Can it be heard again, Gus?
Retired firefighter? Yes, sir.
Yes. The question with Mr. Lee, I think I've mentioned that Thomas first brought it to my attention, and I texted him back on it. I just wanted to read what my comments were, and what I said was, looks like somebody's showcase credentials have been revoked. That's not necessarily confirming that that's what Mr. Lee is, but it could be. Sorry, Mr. Lee, should be expected under the global system of white supremacy. It's not going to be to our convenience as far as where to show up to the game, how much it costs, and whatever. Rhetorically speaking, who has the power? And more than likely, they're prepared for any potential fallout that may come out of, you know, Mr. Lee being mistreated, quote unquote. Past victims, Joe Brown Bomber Lewis, James Cleveland Owens, better known as Jesse Owens. Both of them had income tax lifetime issues. William Cosby, greater confinement. Paul Robeson, banishment from show business, to name a few. I don't believe the New York Knickerbockers will go out of business over Mr. Lee being mistreated. That's basically, I think, where I stand on that issue. I have no care at all for quote unquote professional sports. Thank you.
Took Paul Robeson's passport as well. was that?
Yes, correct.
Was that, let's see, B in Toronto?
Yes, thank you. Thank you, Gus.
Your volume is a little low. If you could maybe get closer to the speaker or raise your voice, maybe.
Is this a bit better?
Yes, ma'am.
Oh, perfect. Thank you. Yes, I just wanted to add that
In terms of the Spike Lee situation, it's unfortunate that he went through the situation that he did. However, it's to be expected under the system of white supremacy, as retired firefighter had mentioned. Included, I wanted to add that in slavery, people who designated as black were branded through the cow branding iron. So it's unfortunate to see that Mr. Lee is branding himself with the New York Knicks attire, much less anyone else who's branding themselves just to appear affluent or to appear to fit in. Because again, that's just another form of reaffirming white supremacy, at least reaffirming the businesses associated to white supremacy, if they are indeed white businesses, of which I believe the owner to the New York Knicks is white. Thank you, and I'll leave the line.
Much obliged to be in Toronto. James Dolan, the New York Knicks owner, is white. And you want to talk about incompetent. James Dolan is, amongst white people, not even regarded as a competent owner. He'll have white people, sometimes large numbers of whites, who will come to the games and chant, "Sell the team. We want a new owner. Get out of here. You're terrible. The team has been bad." Like, this has been documented for years, that he's just been, you know, a terrible owner, but he owns the team. So, you know, what can be done? To have this sort of thing go on, there's no penalty for it. He's not even a quality owner, but the New York Knicks, I think Thomas in New York said they're worth billions of dollars. I think they might even be the most valuable franchise. If they're not the most valuable, they're one of the top two or three in professional sports, period, not just the NBA, but they are one of the top professional sports franchises in North America. They're not even good. They don't even have a competent owner. And now for the past few years, they are known for regularly tossing Negroes out of the stadium, sometime in shackles, during the middle of games, no less. New York Knicks, that is Entertainment USA. Matter of fact, that is Make America Great Again, 2020. President Trump, he could use that for some of his campaign commercials. Making America Great Again. Negroes thrown out nightly at the Garden, like it should be. Four more years. Anybody else? Comments they want to get in? We have about 9 minutes left in the broadcast.
Can I be heard?
Thomas in New York.
Yeah, and, you know, this isn't just, you know, a regular white person. This is one of the most powerful white people. Like, Spike, I don't know what when he thinks he's going to get out of this, what he thinks the media is going to do to James Dolan, who owns a part of the doggone media. You know, like, he owns Cablevision, Optimum TV, one of the largest cable companies in the world. He owns, like I said, Madison Square Garden. He's building that MSG Sphere in Las Vegas and one in London. Like, this guy has real money, you know. He doesn't own 40 acres and a mule, you know. Like, that's what Spike Lee owns, 40 acres and a mule, something we didn't even get, you know. So it's just like a big challenge. And I would tell the gentleman, if he was looking into chemtrails, he could simply just do a YouTube or Google search, and it should put you into literature that will explain it.
Thank you, sir.
Didn't want to minimize Caleb Schmidt, a black teenager who committed suicide in Canada. I was told by the caller who just spoke there, who's asking about chemtrails, they have Black Mental Health Day in Canada, and it's this week. We just read in Packing Them In, Dr. George Washington Carver, he promoted Black Mental Health Week during the month of March. And this is 100 years ago, right at the beginning of the 20th century. But they have Black Mental Health Day in Canada this week, and then they have Caleb Schmidt commit suicide, 13-year-old black male, after being bullied, victimized by racist child in Canada, global system of white supremacy racism. I thought that was important. And again, parents, it's mandatory. Got to talk to your offspring about racism, white supremacy. They are going to be mistreated. They're going to have to deal with racist child, racist teachers. Had that segment about white women educators and their training to talk about racism. That's what they're going to be faced with unless we have done our planning and been really astute. Attempted counter-racist parents and did our planning before we got to the bedroom. So we're not sending our children to the killing field, not sending our children to white women to be educated so they don't have to deal with all of that. Unless all of that work has been done, got to sit down and have lots of conversations so they'll know what to do, what to expect so that they can be adequately prepared. And I also thought that was important because we just talked about, I think retired firefighter just said that there was a young black male who committed suicide down in South Florida, I think on a train track, I believe, just a few weeks back. This young black male, Caleb Schmidt, 13 years old, committing suicide up in Canada. There was a report that just came out about alleging that there is a growing number of suicides among young black people. He was talking about just the United States, but all of this connected to racism, white supremacy, it has a tremendous impact on all of us, our health, well-being. Make sure we're talking about our children, about all of these things. Very dangerous times, always under the system of white supremacy. Did other folks have comments, questions? Remember to set your clocks ahead 1 hour.
Yes, from my studies and experiences of being around young black people, they're looking for answers, and they're not going to get them from white people. And we have not correctly been able to answer our children also. And so the idea of quote-unquote killing oneself is been developing into a popular option, unfortunately, because of it. Thank you.
Could I add something to that?
Yes, sir.
I think back in the chattel slavery era, and even today, some white supremacists would go out, what Mr. Fuller says, go get him, send the hounds and stuff like that. That's the kind of, and go get him, go and get me, a black person to lynch. So, in the 21st century, they're putting so much pressure on black people to the point where they're under so much stress that they're teaching, they're causing people to be so anxious and worried about so many things. There's unemployment, there's homelessness. And people feel so downtrodden. So it's like the racists now are just trying to get people to self-destruct, at this time, it's even more important to be more codified. And what I mean by codified, it means having a plan of how to solve problems, and to gauge into constructive problem solving. It's just that sometimes the racists, they mess around with our food and our drinking water. I learned this from an environmental racism, this causes, it makes it hard for us to be able to think in terms of problem solving. So then, under codification, we need to come up with codes of how to keep ourselves less under the stress, and how to not to take things personal, even though the actions of the racists are very personal. I mean, really, it's not personal. It's just business, as Mr. Fuller would say, because they want to remain in control. And the only way that they're going to remain in control is to keep us in check, meaning non-white people. So So now white people have to have a plan. They have to be quick on their feet. They always have to be thinking, planning, thinking, and having plans to solve whatever problems that do come up. Constructive problem solving. That's the kind of thinking that we need to have. That's it.
Context of white supremacy. Hopefully, when we get to Toronto in May, the plan, we will do some quality eating, some relaxing, detoxifying so that our brain computers can work a little bit more efficiently. We feel a little bit better. White people have studies on this. When you feel a little bit better, when you don't feel right poorly, you can think better. You could do these studies just at days when, you know, you don't feel downtrodden, when racists have not made everything terrible. Maybe when it's a little bit warmer as it starts to move closer to springtime. See if you think a little bit better. But they have studies on this that, oh yeah, your brain computer works substantially more efficiently. Your imagination is likely to be running a little bit better. Problem-solving skills, working at a higher capacity. If you're feeling a little bit happier, having a little bit more vitality, feeling a little bit better about your life, at least your day. Something to keep in mind. But yes, that is the goal. Toronto, looking to have fun. And again, August 5th through August 9th, COWS, Counter-Racist Yoga Retreat, Washington, D.C. So many things we can do. In addition to relaxation, plant-based meals, yoga every day, in addition to all of that, wowee, Washington, D.C., during election season. Email if you have other questions, need more details, untiljustice@gmail.com. Again, my blog post, racism-notes.blogspot.com, the most recent post, has all of the information for the Washington, D.C. excursion. You can check it out. If your question has not been answered, drop me an email. I will do my best to add clarification. With that, much obliged for everyone sharing their time and energy. I hope it has been worthy of your Saturday evening. Again, remember to set your clocks back or forward. Sorry, set your clock forward 1 hour this evening, according to racist man, racist woman, racist child. And again, remember to get extra rest so that you are not feeling disheveled and out of sorts. When Monday comes around, try to get a little bit extra rest. Try to go right to bed this evening so that you're not up really late. See if you can get quality rest. Same thing. Maybe you can go to bed a little bit early Sunday evening so that you won't quite feel as tired when we wake up. On Monday, we can adjust to this a little bit quicker. With that, we will be back shortly. Check Black Talk Radio Network and Facebook for updates to the page. We'll have our next guest on the program. Book Club continues on Thursday. Dr. Sylvia Hood Washington's Packing Them In, session number 3, Thursday, normal time. With that, sobriety would be best. Under conditions of white supremacy, keep our brain computers functioning as best we possibly can. Noxious alcohol, as that was mentioned, as a part of environmental racism. In addition to being sober, let's be buckled up every time we are in a vehicle, passenger or driver. If you're driving, you are sober, buckled up. You do just like Imhan Deasy. If you got your Bluetooth, your hands free, fine. If not, pull over. No driving while you are on the cell phone. Do everything we possibly can to minimize contact with race soldiers, badge or no. With that, Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cal signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim,
your
brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my condition.
Mm-hmm.
Even my conditioning has been conditioned.